I'm standing beside what is perhaps the most famous rock in America, Plymouth Rock, near Boston, Massachusetts. It was here, according to generations of school books, that a band of English pilgrims landed on a blustery day in December 1620, and thereby started a new nation. Never mind that the Mayflower pilgrims almost certainly didn't land on the rock, but at a sheltered inlet nearby. Never mind that there were already large, well-established colonies of English people in Virginia and Newfoundland, or that the rock itself has been moved 5 times and may not now be precisely in its original position. In the popular consciousness, if nowhere else, it was onto this modest slab of granite, barely 4 feet across, that the weary Mayflower pilgrims stepped, and from which America dates its history. Standing here today, surrounded by well-fed tourists and the rumble of passing traffic, it's nearly impossible to imagine what life must have been like in the early days for those 102 adventurers, squeezed between a vast ocean and an untamed wilderness. But 2.5 miles from here, at a place called Plymouth Plantation, a group of dedicated people each year spend $8 million and a great deal of energy recreating and preserving the look, the feel, and even the sounds of that original little colony.
I never kept any animals back in England. Mm-hmm. I never brewed my own beer or made my own bread. I had to learn that all when I come here. It was very difficult indeed.
Yeah. But there, do you take care of animals to yourselves, do you?
Pets.
Mostly. Pets, yeah. We have goats and cows here, and that's their sheep, although the sheep be Master Standish's own, and pigs as well. And of all these creatures, never have I to butcher mine own self. Yeah?
Oh, indeed, indeed. Very gruesome to myself, it seems.
No one knows, of course, precisely what the original colonists sounded like. But here at Plymouth Plantation, a modern-day museum that introduces tourists to life as it was in the Plymouth colony in the 1620s, they're making a game stab at capturing the cadence and flavor of 17th-century English speech. In the flesh, it can be not only quite convincing, but positively startling, as I discovered when I met a confident and pious young woman named Catherine Carver, wife of the colony's first governor. Hello, how do you do?
Oh, very well, sir, very well. I'm sorry, I know not your name.
My name is Bill Bryson.
William Bryson, William. Master Bryson, well met.
Hello, how are you?
Quite well, thank you for asking. I'm much better today.
Why were you better today?
We were very ill this winter past, and there was a grievous condition come amongst us, in which, truth, sir, we have lost half our company.
And how big is the company?
Well, when we begun our voyage, it was of 100 folk, or perhaps a couple more. Now we are diminished to be of a number of perhaps 60. But God be praised, and now with the spring come upon us, and the warmth coming into our bonds once again, that perhaps health shall return unto us. It seemeth thusly.
And you have the most interesting voice. Where are you from?
Originally, sir, I come out of Nottinghamshire. Hast ever heard of Sherwood Forest, sir?
I have indeed, yes.
Oh, you have? Close unto it, though the Retford Hills did come betwixt us and the forest. I come from the town of Storeton, Storeton-le-Steeple, or as some would call it, Storeton-on-the-Clay. It's in the north of Nottinghamshire.
And tell me, how did you come to be here?
My brother-in-love is married to my sister, Bridget, and he is our pastor, the pastor of those of us who have separated out of the English Church and have dwelt for many a long year, for 12 years, in the Low Countries, in the city of Leiden in Holland. And thus we have come here to this new world to remove ourselves out of that city, to remove ourselves from the grim and grisly face of poverty that come upon us like an armed man, sir, and with whom we must needs buckle, we could not flee, and to extend our king's dominions and make England the greater.
That's absolutely wonderful.
You're very kind, sir.
Tell me who you are, really.
My name is Lisa Walbridge, and I've been working as an interpreter at Plymouth Plantation for 6 and a little bit more years now.
Really? And where are you from, really?
I'm from the town of Rochester, Massachusetts. My family's been living in this area since 1620.
Sadly, Catherine Carver, the person recreated by Lisa Walbridge, died before she had barely set foot on American soil. And little wonder. Like all the other Mayflower pilgrims, she had only the scantest sense of how difficult life would be in such a distant and challenging place.
The discrepancy between what the pilgrims found and what they hoped to find was little short of astounding. The consequences, as James Baker, Plymouth Plantation's chief historian, points out, were catastrophic.
The problem with half of them dying on the very first winter was that it was basically exposure. Here they are on an unheated ship coming into New England in the winter, and having to build houses and walk, go through snow and sleet and everything else, and so a lot of people died. But after that first winter, deaths were very, very light, and they did very well.
Didn't they know that they would be coming to a place that had cold, harsh winters? I mean, even if they'd hit the Hudson where they were intended to go, they would have had a hard winter.
No, you see, they made a very logical assumption that the parallels of latitude would put them, if you were had one, we're on the same parallel as Portugal. Add two and two together, and it's nice down here. And why is it colder, and why is it different? They didn't understand. In fact, they thought if they lived here for a while, that English civilization would actually improve the weather. Once you civilize the country, the weather would improve.
Really?
They were kept getting impatient because it didn't.
That any of them survived is something of a miracle. It would be difficult to imagine a group of people more ill-suited to a life in the wilderness. They packed as if they had misunderstood the purpose of the trip. They found room for sundials and candle snuffers, a drum, a trumpet, and a complete history of Turkey. One man brought 126 pairs of shoes and 13 pairs of boots. Yet between them they failed to bring a single cow, or horse, or plow, or fishing line. Those who survived the first winter were in serious peril of meeting a lingering and wretched end when they found a miraculous salvation in the form of a friendly Indian named Squanto, who showed them how to plant corn and hunt wildfowl, and helped them to establish friendly relations with the local chief, in short, who saved their lives. Fortunately for the pilgrims, Squanto was not only a helpful and obliging soul, but spoke excellent English. 15 years earlier, he had been picked up by a party of English explorers who had used him as an interpreter, then taken him back to England with them, where he had settled in the city of London. By the time the Mayflower pilgrims happened upon him, he had only just returned to the New World, having spent roughly half his life abroad. He was far better travelled and infinitely more worldly than any of the pilgrims. It was the beginning of a relationship between natives and settlers that was sometimes cordial, sometimes brutal, and never predictable, as the Native American historian Nanny Pashamit told me.
It was extremely complex because of different Native political entities and their experiences prior to the pilgrims' arrival with English explorers, Dutch explorers, French explorers, traders, fishermen, any number of different kinds of people. There had been nearly 100 years of contact with Europeans before the pilgrims got here in this area.
So when the colonists arrived, it wasn't a great shock to see these white people tumbling off a boat.
No, it wasn't. If anything, the native people here knew more about the English than the English knew about them because of the years of contact. In the first ship that bringing permanent colonists to southern New England, Wampanoag Territory, only one had been to the so-called New World before, and that was Stephen Hopkins, who had been to Virginia. But other than that, none of them had any direct contact with native peoples before, whereas they were already people here or were fluent English speakers.
Everywhere they turned in their newfound land, the American colonists were confronted with objects, conditions, and phenomena they had never seen before, from mosquitoes to poison ivy. And they began modifying their speech almost from the first day. As early as 1622, residents of Massachusetts were using pond in a distinctively American sense to describe a large, natural body of water. Creek in England described an inlet of the sea. In America, it came to signify a stream. Where they could, the colonists stuck doggedly to the words of the Old World. Scores, perhaps hundreds, of words that would later die out in Britain were faithfully preserved in America. Fall for autumn, mad in the sense of angry, bug for an insect, hog for a pig, and countless other terms that we now think of as distinctively American were in fact old English words that would eventually die out in their place of birth. Sometimes, however, they had no choice but to come up with new words, often by the simple expedient of joining together two existing words to create a new compound. Blue jay, bullfrog, catfish, rattlesnake, bobcat, bluegrass, and glowworm. Still other words they borrowed from the Indians. Powwow, possum, raccoon, moccasin, caucus, hickory, hammock, and some 300 others in common usage. For place names particularly, they often borrowed native terms, invariably modifying them in the process.
It's very difficult to say what some of these place names actually were originally, because some of them go through several variations because of English scribes trying to record a word that, for, you know, all practical purposes, was only spoken. Now all of a sudden they're challenged to come up with the phonetic spelling for it and how many letters they used and all these things. Sometimes I think is excessive, like two T's in Massachusetts. I never understood that. And the S is foreign at the end. That's English applied. And that comes, you know, from how they used it. The Massachusetts was a place, and they talked about the Massachusetts Bay or the Bay at Massachusetts, and the way they applied the native word began to change over time, because originally the place name meant the Great Hill Place, Massa. Wachu Ut. Masa meaning big or great. Wachu meaning hill or mountain. Actually, Wachuis meaning hill rather than mountain. Wachu would be mountain. Wachuis would be a hill, a diminutive mountain. And Ut is place.
Partly as a result of this absorption of Indian words, partly from lack of daily contact with Britain, and partly, no doubt, from whim, American English soon began wandering off in new directions. As the linguistic historian John Algio notes, it is an entirely natural process.
The thing is, you have different physical conditions. The impression American gets on first going to England is what a manicured country it is. Everything is clipped and neat and lovely little hedgerows, and it's all just so well tended. And America, by contrast, looks gross and rough and rugged and neglected. But the difference in the size of the countries, the difference in the intensity of the population, means that the relationship between human beings and the landscape is quite different in the two places. England has no use for the word prairie, which is an American, borrowing from French, but it's an Americanism, an American word. Americans couldn't get by without the word prairie because we've got them. Huge stretches of flat land with little other than grass on it. So the physical realities mold the language. We don't have much need for a word like dell or indeed even for meadow much, because those things are not prominent in the landscape.
I wonder, can you tell me a little bit about the background of the differences in pronunciation as they exist now between
America British and Britain?
Yeah.
Yes, all right. In the beginning, of course, there weren't any differences of pronunciation because America was settled by English speakers in the early 17th century. And at that time, Americans and Britons spoke exactly alike. The way they spoke was not the way Americans speak today, nor was it the way Britons speak today. They spoke early 17th century English. The language changes. It changes constantly. There is no language which does not go on changing from generation to generation. When two communities cease to speak together, their languages will change in different directions. The Atlantic Ocean was a very great dividing force between America and Britain before the invention of jet planes. And consequently, the English language in America and in Britain developed in different ways, in pronunciation and grammar and vocabulary and spelling and all sorts of ways. And so the pronunciation which we use in America today and the pronunciation which is used in Britain today are both developments of that early 17th century pronunciation, developments in different directions. In some respects, the pronunciation of present-day Britain is closer to the common ancestor, the 17th century English. In some respects, American pronunciation is closer to 17th century English. They both differ from it.
And why do we say lieutenant and they say lieutenant?
Well, a lot of words had more than one pronunciation in quite early times. And what frequently happened in those cases is that one of the pronunciations would survive in Britain and the other would survive in America. And that's what happened with lieutenant versus lieutenant.
Same again with words like schedule and schedule.
Schedule and schedule are very strange because, in fact, historically, both Americans and Britons are wrong. That is to say, the historically expected pronunciation of that word is sedgel, with an initial S. It got a fancy spelling from people who thought they ought to gussy up the spelling system to make words look more impressive. And then both Americans and Brits began mispronouncing it. So both schedule and schedule are both mispronunciations based on the spelling.
What about the argument you often hear from Britons that one of the ways that they... pieces of evidence they put forward for the inferiority of American English and certainly American pronunciation of English is that we don't enunciate distinctions between sounds as clearly as they do. Like, for instance, we turn writer and rider into
foreigner. For most Americans, R-I-D-E-R and W-R-I-T-E-R are homophonous. They're pronounced exactly alike. They're both writer. The sound which is there is neither quite a T nor a D. It's something different from either one, but it's the same in both words. That's a characteristic American pronunciation. And you may say, well, that confuses the pronunciation. But on the other hand, one can also cite examples like American Dictionary and Secretary, where we give full value to all four syllables, and the Britons, as it were, slur them into secretary and dictionary. Leaving out syllables. So if you want to talk about sloppiness of pronunciation, we can each accuse the other of being sloppy. In fact, there is no sloppiness. There are simply different fashions of pronunciation.
So Americans developed their own fashions in speech, a practice that the British quickly came to regard as vaguely impertinent, if not actually loathsome. The first recorded attack on an American usage came as early as 1735, when an English visitor named Francis Moore referred to the young city of Savannah as standing upon a hill overlooking a river which they, in barbarous English, call a bluff. Since that time, complaints about Americans and the indignities they inflict on the English language have been nearly unrelenting. Samuel Johnson, Francis Trollope, William Cobbett, Charles Dickens, and other commentators beyond counting have all taken time out from other more worthwhile pursuits to condemn the way Americans conduct themselves linguistically. Only recently, Prince Charles complained of the way Americans, as he put it, invent all sorts of new nouns and verbs and make words that shouldn't be.
This is Radio Free DC, the G. Gordon Liddy Show.
Of course, there are many in America who feel that standards of usage are declining. G. Gordon Liddy, the hyper-conservative host of a national radio program, regularly addresses the matter on his show.
I get a lot of compliments saying, you know, thank God you make the effort to speak the language correctly and so on, and for that reason we like our children to listen to you. But you see, their teachers don't even speak it correctly. I received a copy of a letter here from a principal who has a PhD in education and made this now common error of I'm sure the teacher that instead of I'm sure the teacher who, and wrote this drivel and filled with buzzwords, we call them over here. But I think if we have rules of grammar, for example, they are best adhered to, because otherwise we become susceptible of the problems of the Tower of Babel.
Whatever the state of American English today, and that's a subject we'll come back to in later programs, The fact of the matter is that Americans have given the English language hundreds of words that are seldom recognized as Americanisms, and which even the most fastidious xenophobe could not do without. Prince Charles may not realize it, but every time he parks a car, stubs his toe, makes a beeline, gives his okay to something, endorses a report, sidesteps an issue, interviews a servant, makes his mind up, even keeps a stiff upper lip, anytime he uses these or any of many hundreds of other everyday expressions, he is employing Americanisms. There are no two ways about it. Another Americanism, by the way. No one knows for sure when American English began to sound distinctively different from British English. But we do know that in 1739 there was a kind of psychological milestone in relations between the two. In that year, after decades of provocation, the Spanish Navy captured a British ship preying on their trade lanes between the Old and New Worlds. To show their displeasure, the Spanish cut off the ear of the commander, one Edward Jenkins, prompting Britain to launch the obscure, if interesting-sounding, War of Jenkins' Ear. The war was, in fact, short and dull, but it did have a couple of notable linguistic spin-offs. One was the introduction of a daily ration of rum and water by the fleet's commander, Edward Vernon. Vernon's nickname was Old Grog, and the drink became known, almost inevitably, as grog. But there was another, even more significant new term to come to life during the war. For it was then, for the first time, that British troops began to refer to their colonial cousins, who were fighting alongside them, as Americans. Heretofore they called them colonials or provincials. American had been recorded as early as 1578, but previously it had referred only to the native Indians. No one realized it at the time, but a new nation had begun. One of Commander Vernon's officers, incidentally, was an impressionable young Virginian named Lawrence Washington, who was so impressed with the admiral that when he returned home after the war, he renamed his homestead Mount Vernon in his honor. Lawrence Washington retired to a happy life as a Virginia planter. His younger half-brother George inherited Mount Vernon from him in 1754. Here at Mount Vernon today, as on many other days, they are reenacting scenes from the conflict in which George Washington was to become the central figure. Against a backdrop of musket fire, I talked to two of the Mount Vernon guides, Lee Curley and Joanne LaJoy.
Oh, jeez. No matter where we go. When he was 17, wasn't it?
That's right.
He wanted to join the British Navy. Because Lawrence, his oldest brother, whom he respected and looked up to so much, had been in the British Navy.
He asked Lawrence to write a letter to his mother and try to give all the reasons why, you know, he could join the Navy or the Merchant Marine. And she refused.
He was probably on the ship. And she sent her brother and just kind of plunked him off the ship. No, he can't do this.
Now, did he look upon himself as an Englishman before the Revolution?
I think he did. Before Virginia, no. He saw himself always as a Virginian.
But an Englishman living in Virginia?
I think he saw himself as a Virginian who had an English ancestry.
Well, it irritated him that he did not have a full British rank. Remember, he had a rank in the militia.
Right.
And after the French and Indian Wars, he wasn't granted full British.
He wanted to be in the British Army.
The British regular Army.
He wanted that very much.
He wanted that distinction, not
war. Why was he not granted? Was it because
he was a colonist.
So no colonists were given full rank in the British Army?
I don't know. I don't know about any place other than Virginia. They may have. I have no idea. But he felt that they looked down on the colonists as not being good soldiers, not being good thinkers, not being whatever it was that they thought the standard of a British officer should be, and it made him very angry.
Painful as it may be for these two ladies to accept that Washington was ever less than wholeheartedly an American, in fact, like nearly all his fellow colonials, he thought of himself as a loyal Englishman. and even after the outbreak of fighting, was toasting the British crown, if not King George himself, each night in the officers' mess. It would be too much, of course, to say that Washington went to war with Britain because he had been snubbed by the military. But it is certainly true that the physical separateness of the two nations and their growing differences in speech, temperament, and outlook made a breach all but inevitable, and Washington felt this as keenly as anyone. In 1776, when he and some 40 fellow revolutionaries gathered in Philadelphia to launch the Declaration of Independence, the step they were taking was highly risky and wholly irreversible. The penalty for treason was to be hanged, cut down while still alive, disemboweled and forced to watch one's organs burned, and finally beheaded and quartered. Their estates would be seized, and their widows and children subjected ever after to a life of hardship and abuse. They invested their faith in a military commander of no real standing, at the head of an army that was untrained, under-equipped, and only fitfully loyal to the cause. For 8 long years, against considerable odds, Washington prosecuted a war that it often seemed he had no chance of winning. And yet, win he did. In 1783, after the decisive Battle of Yorktown, the British commander Lord Cornwallis surrendered his sword to this colonial upstart while a band played "The World Turned Upside Down." America's 13 colonies had become independent, but they were a long way from being, in any real sense, a nation. They needed still to develop a sense of themselves, a patriotic instinct. And in the next century, they would do that as no country ever had before. But that is another program.
It was in this room that Washington was officially notified he had been elected our first president. And then just 10 years later, following his death upstairs, his body was moved to this room for 3 days before he was buried.
This is Mount Vernon, the home of America's first president and arguably its greatest hero, George Washington. His achievements are legend, but of Washington the man we know very little. His official correspondence is among the most extensive of any American president's, but only 2 personal letters, both to his wife Martha, survive, like this one, written at the very beginning of the 8-year War of Independence.
Oh, here it is.
Here it is. Okay.
Why don't you read it?
This was June 23rd, 1775, my dearest. As I am within a few minutes of leaving the city, I could not think of departing from it without dropping you a line, especially as I do not know whether it will be in my power to write again till I get to the camp at Boston. I go fully trusting...
Having defeated the British, the new and grateful nation would have given Washington anything he asked for. He sought nothing but to return to his beloved plantation on the banks of the Potomac River in Virginia. But he was not to be left in peace. In May 1787, he was persuaded to travel to Philadelphia to preside over what would become known as the Constitutional Convention. Though America had won its independence from Britain 4 years before, it was not in any real sense a nation, but rather an uneasy alliance of states bound by a document known formally, and rather hopefully, as the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. In fact, there wasn't much union at all, much less a perpetual one. Many of the states were engaged in prolonged squabbles over territory and other matters. Virginia and Maryland actually went to war for a time over oyster beds. Other states, like Vermont, for instance, were so dissatisfied that they constantly threatened to secede. In short, America desperately needed 3 things. It needed a constitution, a set of rules by which to govern itself. It needed vigorous and decisive leadership, and it needed, above all, a sense of itself. Fortunately, it had, or was about to get, all 3. Those who assembled in Philadelphia included some of the most steady, reflective, and brilliant intellects any young nation has ever produced. Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Dickinson, Edmund Randolph, and of course, the regal, rock-like George Washington. For 4 months, through one of the hottest summers in American history, they labored 6 days a week, creating a framework for government that has lasted to this day. In clear, confident prose, they stated their aims.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted.
The Constitution was the quintessential political document of the Age of Reason. Clear, rational, precise. Not a word was wasted. At just 25 pages, it was a model of concision. The Constitution for the state of Oklahoma, by contrast, runs to 152 pages. And nearly every word is regarded in America to this day as a kind of holy writ. The principles it set down, particularly the 10 Amendments that became known as the Bill of Rights, formed the bedrock of American political thought. 2 amendments in particular, those dealing with freedom of speech and the right to bear arms, are seldom out of the news. Recently, they were conjoined when radio talk show host G. Gordon Liddy, who was jailed in the 1970s for his part in the Watergate scandal, offered advice over the air on how to kill federal agents if they attempt to take your guns away. This was too much even for many of Liddy's fellow conservatives. It drove Michael Gartner, a leading liberal journalist, to describe him in a national newspaper column as a scumbag. I asked Gartner if Liddy's remarks were serious or tongue-in-cheek.
Serious, serious, absolute serious advice. Where to shoot them, where their bulletproof, how far up and how far down their bulletproof vest goes, and so shoot them in the neck, but then he changed his mind, said they can duck, so the best way to do is several shots to the groin first.
And is that covered by free speech?
Oh, sure.
You can say that.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. You can say virtually anything and call anyone virtually any name. You can advocate the overthrow of the government. You can call for violence. You can march with anti-Semitic, anti-black slogans. You can do almost anything you want, because the theory is that you respond to speech with speech, that good speech drives out bad. And once you start censoring, where do you stop?
Do you support that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm an absolutist on the First Amendment.
Even if someone is up making incendiary remarks?
No, I see...
people are actually acting on...
I see censorship as a far greater danger to democracy than whatever incendiary remarks a person might make.
It is remarkable to think that people of two such diametrically opposed beliefs as Gartner and Liddy could be united by a document drawn up 2 centuries ago in a sweltering Philadelphia legislative chamber by people whose own views were no less diametrically opposed. They came from all over, these 50 or so delegates, from every economic and social background, and with widely differing views on how to build the new nation. But they had one thing in common. They were all intent on becoming Americans. So what did they sound like, these new Americans? Robert Easton, an actor, voice coach, and phonetics expert, has spent much of his life examining the roots of American accents and has combined scholarship, intuition, and a gift for mimicry to establish how Washington and his colleagues would have talked.
I made it a point to find out, because just as a matter of coincidence, for the American Learning Channel, we're working on a series about the American Revolution, and I'm playing a number of the parts, including George Washington. So I've had to research it rather heavily. In those days, in Southern plantation speech, what was called the palatalized K and G, or a K and G sound, was very common. So he would have said garrison instead of garrison. He would have said cabbage, and he would have said county instead of county. And that palatalized K and G, where the tongue drops behind the lower teeth and becomes like a KY or a GY, was very big in upper-class British English several hundred years ago.
So could you just give us a snatch of what...
Well, like when George Washington is talking about Valley Forge, he said, men without blankets, without shoes, they're starving, and one could trace their bloody footprints through the snow because they had no shoes. It was very much like that.
Is it possible to say at what point American English started to become perceptibly distinct from British English?
Yeah, there's two schools of thought about that. Some people claim that at the time of the American Revolution that colonial speech was the same as speech in Britain. From my research, I don't think so. A lot of people commented who came over from England commented that it was quite different in the colonies, that there were differences developing in vocabulary as England moved to newer vocabulary, perhaps the colonies stayed with the older, or sometimes the colonies were picking up words from the American Indian languages, names for animals and plants and so forth. So I think they were already quite different by the time of the American Revolution.
As a distinct American accent began to emerge, distinctions began to appear within it.
I have Hollywood moguls call me, and they say, we just hired this actor, and he's got to do the North Carolina dialect. And I say, the North Carolina dialect? Yeah. And I said, okay, well, do you want Outer Banks? Do you want Tidewater? Do you want Piedmont? Do you want Great Smokies? And he'll say, yeah. So I have to read the script and determine which regional area, because as you know, American dialects do not change at state borders. Every state, particularly the ones on the East Coast, have a large number of dialects, which quite often spill over into contiguous states.
So you just mentioned, what was it, five separate dialects?
I think I mentioned four.
Four, all coexisting in North Carolina.
Yes.
Can you give us an example of how those would differ?
Well, okay. The Outer Banks is what they call a fossil dialect. And that, you go to the Outer Banks, and the old fishermen, very West Country in their origin, they talk about the high-tiders, are the people who live in the high-tide area, the high-tiders, whereas as soon as you get inland in North Carolina, it would be the high-tiders, not the high-tiders. Then when you get into the tidewater area, which is up and down the coast, it's R-dropping, and a very fronted long O, which in fact surprises people because it sounds very kind of English. Even Billy Graham will say, Moses, and Moses spoke with the Lord, and he broke the commandments. So you get that O. Then as you gradually move west, and you move into the Great Smokies, and you get into that area, it's very Ulster influenced. And what do you do like it? And the thing is, and he didn't tell me about that. Now the interesting thing, Liam Neeson, who is from Ulster, I was on location with him, not too far from that area, in the eastern part of Kentucky, in a town which is very aptly called Hazard. And there'd been a lot of killings and feud fights and stuff in Hazard. And I was there coaching Liam Neeson and Patrick Swayze to be brothers. Now, because Liam was from Ulster and had never heard this type of Appalachian dialect, I was able to build on the similarities. And I pointed to my ring, and I said to Liam, what do you call that? And he said, a rang. And I said, right, instead of a ring with an I, it's a rang with an E. So that's what they call it here. Do you like my rang? And the thing is, and the bird on the wing, and he had him a fling. So I said, and they say F, indifferent. So I said, if you use that Ulster widening of the short I to a short E, it'll work. Now then I pointed to the F-I-R-E, and I said, what do they call that in Ulster? And he said, the far. And I said, right. So I said, if you use an Ulster far, and then a London plies, you get the far plies. So it's not, wouldn't be an Ulster far plies, not far plus plies, but far plus a London plies, and you've got it made in the shade. So he was a very apt pupil.
One of the more intractable myths of this period is that an early Congress considered abandoning the English language as a kind of snub to the British and adopting German, Hebrew, or some other language as the national speech of the United States. But like so much else to do with this period, the story is mythical. However, considerable thought was given to the possibility of renaming the country. Among the many suggested titles were Appalachia, Allegheny, Fredonia, and, rather surprisingly, United States of Columbia. I say surprisingly because for most of the previous 250 years, Christopher Columbus had been virtually forgotten in America. Not until after the Revolutionary War, when Americans began casting around for heroes unconnected with the British monarchy, was the name Columbus resurrected, generally in the more elegant Latinized form Columbia, and his memory imbued with a spirit of grit and independent fortitude that wasn't altogether merited. Nearly all the hundreds of Columbuses and Columbias in America, Columbia University, Mount Columbia, the Columbia River, Columbia, North Carolina, date from this period. Other heroes of America's founding were given equally lavish and fictitious treatment. Patrick Henry, Paul Revere, James Otis, Benjamin Franklin, and others were credited with statements or acts of heroism that simply never happened. To this day, American schoolchildren are taught James Otis's ringing words, "Taxation without representation is tyranny," and Patrick Henry's "Give me liberty or give me death," even though there isn't the tiniest shred of evidence that either of them ever said any such thing. Nearly all of the symbols and traditions that Americans associate with nationhood, Uncle Sam, the Stars and Stripes, Thanksgiving, Washington and the Cherry Tree, the veneration of the Pilgrim Fathers in Plymouth Rock, fireworks on the 4th of July, the ringing of the Liberty Bell, all of these date from the first critical half-century of American independence. Almost nothing from this period couldn't be used to provide fuel for patriotism. Even the humiliating bombardment of Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor during the War of 1812 provided inspiration. It was during this brief engagement that Francis Scott Key, a young American lawyer sent to try to negotiate the release of a prisoner, found himself detained on a British warship. Through the night, Key watched as the British fleet, practically unopposed, hurled a colorful fusillade of explosives at Fort McHenry. When dawn broke and Key saw the American flag still flying, tattered but defiant, he was sufficiently moved to dash off a poem. The poem was, frankly, terrible, didn't rhyme and didn't scan, but it struck a chord with the American public. Published under the title Defense of Fort McHenry, and set to the funereal tune of an old English song called To Anacreon in Heaven, it became a sensation. Soon, almost everyone had forgotten its original title and was calling it The Star-Spangled Banner. Patriotism, overt, fervent, unashamed, became and has remained a kind of fixation in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, please rise to honor America as Richard Giglio plays our national anthem.
The national anthem is De Rigueur, at public gatherings of all kinds throughout America, as here at a Boston Red Sox baseball game. This is a source of some puzzlement to an immigrant like Dr. Motke Schechter.
I'll tell you, I'm not an American.
I'm an American citizen. I served in the American Army, but I'm basically, and I've lived most of my years here, but my formative years were in Europe. I can't quite swallow or digest to hear the national anthem at sports events or at the end of a radio program when the, what does the national anthem do there? It's, from my point of view, from the eyes of a Romanian-born Jew, it looks overkill. It's unnecessary. Of course, if everybody gets up, I get up too. I can't sit when everybody stands. I don't go to ball games. That's another thing. But I never understood this idea of hoisting the flag at occasions that have nothing to do with the country.
By the late 19th century, America began building increasingly grand monuments to its heroes, as here at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. Built in a classical style and standing before a vast reflecting pool, it contains a statue of Lincoln, some 20 feet high, sat on a marble throne, looking sage and godlike. This is a monument for a Jupiter or Zeus, not a mere mortal. All of this had a powerful, unifying effect on the American psyche. And yet, in other respects, Americans continued to go their separate ways, and nowhere more visibly than in terms of their dialects. Those who lived along the eastern seaboard tended to be conservative in their speech and accent, and proved far more susceptible to changing fashions in Britain. Those who moved westward, into and eventually over the Appalachian Mountains, tended to a life of greater isolation. Thus, changes in British speech habits were often aped along the Atlantic coast of America, but not inland. As the linguistic historian John Algio notes,
characteristically, Americans preserve the sound R where it is spelled, so that we would typically say mother and orphan, whereas the R in standard British and RP is lost in such words. Well, the pronunciation of R is historically expected, and it certainly occurred there in the early 17th century. That loss is a relatively recent one, late 18th century loss in words of that sort. It's an innovation in British English. Or another example would be words of the type class, path, bath, calf, etc. The American so-called flat A is historically the expected one. It's the older one. It's the way everybody pronounced those words in the early 17th century. The British pronunciation of class, path, bath, cough, and so on is a relatively recent innovation coming in probably in the early 19th century, beginning, incidentally, as an unfashionable pronunciation, a Cockney pronunciation. Shelley, who went to Oxford, indeed who was sent down from Oxford for atheism, would almost certainly have said class, path, and bath, whereas Keats, who was notorious as the Cockney poet, would probably have said class, path, and bath. That began as a lower-class British pronunciation and then moved up.
Now, isn't that unexpected for a pronunciation to move from the lower-class orders up to the...
One might suppose so, since you think that prestige is something in the upper classes. But in fact, we see this happening repeatedly, both in Britain and in America. We see it happening right now. In America, a dominant influence on pronunciation is that of urban blacks, who are not what one would normally consider to be of a prestige class. What happens is that kids... Children do not learn their language from their teachers. They don't learn it from their parents. They learn it primarily from their playmates, from their peers. And there is very often a need to rebel against the older generation. And one way of rebelling is to adopt pronunciations which annoy the older generation. And so you get a kind of pattern in which lower class pronunciations influence upper class usage. Until they become upper class, of course.
Satirist George Carlin experienced something of this firsthand on the streets of New York.
As we grew up, we lived in a partly black area, as I explained before, right on the edge of Harlem.
in an Irish enclave, I call it. And we always thought, we, our generation of white Irish kids, not the ones before us, but our generation in the 50s, we saw the black street culture as being very cool. It was beginning to emerge in general society. People were starting to notice there was a style. There was a true black street style. And we thought it was cool, and we tried to emulate it. And most of the Irish kids would talk, you know, could talk like that, you know, and talk some black stuff, man, be able to say, you know, talk, hey, man, what's up? What you, well, up, what's up wasn't popular at the time, you understand? But a lot of things were, you know, and they could talk all that. And yet you would never hear a black guy saying, you know, why don't we go down and go swimming in the river today? You know, it's just like whites wanted to be like blacks. Blacks didn't want to be like whites. And that, I'll leave that to the sociologists and the ethnographers and so forth.
In whatever accents they spoke, Americans became increasingly confident in their speech. The 19th century became for American English what the Elizabethan age was for British English. With an unexpected suddenness, there came from America a great outpouring of words and expressions. Standpoint, cross purposes, influential, scrumptious, cagey, bogus, blizzard, okay, words that it is difficult to imagine we ever did without. Of political terms alone, America in the 19th century gave the world filibuster, junket, gag rule, straw vote, spoil system, lobbyist, standard bearer, gerrymander, to campaign, to muckrake, to mend fences, to whitewash, to keep the ball rolling, to talk bunkum, to debunk. They created wave after wave of colorful expressions, expressions that gave the American language a particular vitality and liveliness that characterizes it yet. To make the fur fly, to have a chip on one's shoulders, to go haywire, to back down, to talk through one's hat, to paint the town red, to make one's mind up, to talk turkey, to bark up the wrong tree. Americans not only created new words, but recombined old words in new ways. They added prepositions to common verbs to give them new or heightened significance. To pass out, to check in, to check out, to show off, to hold on, to hold off, to hold out. At the same time, Americans unashamedly made verbs from nouns with a vigor that hadn't been seen in English since Shakespeare. To interview, to package, to panic, to curb, to corner, to notice, to locate, to placate, to park, to sidestep, to hustle. All these and many more are Americanisms without which the English language clearly would be very much the poorer. Predictably, nearly all these met with strenuous objections from the British, just as American neologisms spark the ire of the likes of Prince Charles today. Captain Basil Hall, a professional traveler, writer, and, it would appear, half-wit, spoke for many when he remarked that all this linguistic novelty was unnecessary because, as he put it, there are enough words already. Nonetheless, the word stuck, and on both sides of the Atlantic we have a richer language for it. American English had at last found a voice to go with its flag and anthem and national symbols like Uncle Sam. But at the same time, it had found something even more gratifying and more certain to guarantee its prospects in the world. It had found wealth, wealth beyond the dreams of other nations. But that, to use yet another Americanism, is another story and another program.
I'm standing on Old Highway 1, historically the main road along America's eastern seaboard. Today, as you can hear, it's a major highway, busy with passing traffic. But 200 years ago, it was little more than a rutted track.
Until well into the 19th century, America had virtually no highways worthy of the name. Signposts, maps, and other aids to the bewildered traveler were all but unknown. Such roads as existed would often disappear at riverbanks or dissolve into a confusion of forks. Those who traveled any distance at all, even along main routes, generally had to employ guides to show them the way. Such physical remoteness between communities had a powerful effect on accents. Far more than today, people spoke with localized dialects. A person from Plymouth, Massachusetts, sounded detectably different from someone from Provincetown, 20 miles away across Cape Cod Bay, and this pattern was repeated all over the country. Dr. Frederick Cassidy, the Dean of American Dialectologists, has spent 60 years tracking down regionalisms, mostly for the celebrated multi-volume Dictionary of American Regional English. He and a band of dedicated field workers spent years venturing into swamps, farm fields, and mountain fastnesses trying to capture American speech in all its variety. Their tape recordings represent a unique archive.
I was captain of a boat then. I mean, you know, I've been on water ever since a boy. I've been ever since a little boy on the water, but I mean, I've taken captain.
Well, you make a keel first from the model, then you take the stem and the stern. You make a mold, so there's sections of it.
I know they come one evening, I just was fixing to quit working in my garden, and he come and he says, this Miss Davis? And I said, that's what they call me.
Most of these voices were recorded in the 1960s, and already the accents may be dying out. As Dr. Cassidy explains, most dialects require a measure of isolation to survive.
Unless you have a pretty tight community, you will have change, with people going away from it to try to better themselves, perhaps, or new people coming in for some reason, or being brought in for reasons somebody starts a new industry, let's say, and the people who think they can get a job will come in, and they'll come in from half a dozen different places. And so the local language is subtly but definitely changing all the time. There simply isn't any stability in language, except where you have isolation.
Today, most examples of this isolation are found only on islands along the East Coast, where people have had relatively little contact with the outside world for generations. On Tangier Island in Chesapeake Bay, the echoes of a Cornish ancestry are clearly evident.
Our voice, our language hasn't changed since people first moved to Tangier Island. We still speak the same accent, or so some people have told us.
But such distinctive speech communities are rare in America, and even these are disappearing fast.
There were some offshore islands, but they were islands in which the people who owned the plantations, the whites who owned the plantations, were subject very much to malaria and other diseases. So in the disease season, they would go away from the islands, come back to the mainland, and leave the blacks to themselves on the islands. And they spoke their Creole without any annoyance from the white-speaking people. Now, it's a dialect. Gullah is the name of it. It's also called Geechee sometimes. But in any case, it was, and it's still to some extent hanging on. But they're putting bridges over to those islands now, and they're developing them as southern resort communities, and lots of people from the north going down there to spend part of the winter, you see. It changes the culture totally. And the only thing that the descendants of the blacks can do is to learn the current American English. And so only the old folks now speak their Gullah dialect.
Today there are a few clearly identifiable accents in America, in New York, Boston, the Deep South, and so on. But nothing like as many as in Britain. And even in a place like Boston or New York, only some of the people speak with the local accent. The reason for this is clear. Unlike Britons, Americans have seldom settled in any one place for very long. Why stay a lifetime in Charleston or Providence when there is a whole undiscovered continent and the rich, irresistible possibility of a new start in life, just beyond your doorstep. To Americans, the West has always been an ever-changing concept. At the time of the first federal census in 1790, 95% of America's 4 million people lived hard by the eastern seaboard, and the West was virtually everything else. By the 1820s, it extended not much beyond the Appalachian Mountains. The leading paper of Kentucky, just one state inland from the East Coast, was called the Argus of Western America. Thomas Jefferson thought it would take 1,000 years for Americans to populate the vast emptiness of the West. But he hadn't reckoned on the great waves of immigration of the 19th century and the odd restlessness of character of the American people. From the start, Americans seldom stayed anywhere long. Jamestown, the first settlement in Virginia, was a ghost town less than a century after it was founded, and the pattern was repeated endlessly as people moved west. For every Chicago and Milwaukee that thrived, thousands of others passed quietly away. In Iowa alone, no fewer than 2,200 communities came and went in its first century of existence. One of the more enduring images of westward migration, reinforced by 1,000 movies, is of long, orderly lines of Conestoga wagons lumbering across the prairies. In fact, these wagons were much too heavy for the long haul to Oregon or California. Lighter wagons, called prairie schooners, were used instead, and they were hauled by mules or oxen, not horses. Nor, for the most part, did they proceed single file, but rather fanned out into an advancing line up to 10 miles wide to avoid each other's dust and the ruts of earlier travelers. The Oregon Trail, in short, wasn't really a trail at all, but more a kind of notional corridor. But then most of what is popularly connected with the West is based on myth or misunderstanding, and nowhere more so than with the traditional idea of the shootout. At the Gene Autry Museum of the West in Los Angeles, I joined historian John Langelier at an audiovisual display.
The trouble started when Virgil Earp called out to the cowboy gang,
"Boys, throw up your hands. I want your guns."
His brother Wyatt was ready for a fight.
"You have been looking for a fight, and you have it."
One of their arch rivals, Billy Clanton, was nervous.
"Don't shoot me. I don't want to fight."
One of Clanton's partners, Tom McLary, yelled back,
"I haven't got anything, boys. I'm disarmed."
Virgil Earp yelled back to Tom McLary,
"Hold. I don't want that."
"Gotcha now. Blaze away. You're a daisy, kid."
The so-called gunfight at the OK Corral had ended.
John, did my ears deceive me, or did I hear someone say, "Blaze away, you're a daisy"?
"Blaze away, you're a daisy" is precisely what you heard. The words from Doc Holliday, taken from the testimony after the so-called OK Corral fight. Holliday, being a Southerner, would use certain terminology, not unlike many of Southerners of the time and who came to the West, but the daisy being synonymous with a pansy. He was questioning the manhood of his opponent, of course, and so that was an epithet thrown out and as a challenge. And of course, the blaze away, very dramatic, but again, a court testimony. Much of what you heard, fairly formal, because it's Victorian period, 1880 or so. Several of these people, like Holliday, having an education. A lot of Southern mannerisms in the speech at that time, of course, again, with people like Holliday and others who had come from the so-called border states of Missouri, places like Tennessee, Kentucky, and so they brought their particular Southern traditions with them, and yet a great deal of informality in the contractions, given where the language was heading at that particular time. And so you did hear something that sounded like Hollywood, but it was true with a few nuances of old Southern gentleman, if you will, with a drawl.
And yet, from the narrative we've just heard, it says that the gunfights were a rare occurrence.
Precisely. Those were mostly an illusion created at a much later date. There were altercations, just as there are today. Someone might exchange words, and then words would lead to fisticuffs or knives or bullets in a bar. But chances are, in most cases, such as the Earps, rather than facing off an opponent a la the Gunsmoke opening with the James Arness figure walking down the street and shooting the man at the end of the street, they may go down a dark alleyway and do what they called another Western term, buffaloing. Where that comes from, I can't tell you, but it was simply walking behind an opponent in the dark where he could not hear you, taking the butt end of your revolver and essentially knocking him out or bludgeoning him over the head so that he would then be rendered unconscious, and it was a little bit easier then to deal with him than to face him at paces that were literally just a few feet away. In the case of the OK Corral fight, one of the men who was shot was smoldering when he hit the wall because the muzzle blasts were so close that the flames from the exchange of fire had caught some of his outer clothing or garment on fire.
Those who were shot seldom got up again. Scarcely a Western movie has ever been made in which at least one character hasn't taken a bullet in the thigh or shoulder, but shrugged it off with a manly wince and continued firing. In fact, 19th century bullets were so slow, relatively speaking, and so soft, that they almost never moved cleanly through the victim's body. Instead, they bounced around like a pinball and exited with a hole like a fist punched through paper. Even if they miraculously missed the victim's vital organs, he would almost invariably suffer deep and incapacitating shock and bleed to death in minutes. Myths aside, the move west immensely enriched the American vocabulary.
A good deal of the dialogue, partner or what have you, would be obviously the who's gal, lariats or lassos and that sort of thing were there. Ironically, of course, none of those terms, who's gal or lariat, or rodeo or those things had anything to do with the English language originally, but borrowed heavily from the Spanish origins of what had been the cowboy.
So where do we get huzgal?
Huzgal is essentially the huzgal, the huzgal was a jail, that in Spanish meant jail. And so such things would easily come out. The term buckaroo, which is many times had come to be a cowboy, we don't hear it as much today, but in an earlier time, you were a buckaroo, vaquero. Buckaroo. So an English-speaking tongue couldn't quite get the words to work or decided to turn them into their own. And so there's a whole litany of things here that we can see that continued to have a meaning. Branco, bronc, today. Cowboy has a bronc. Cincha, cinch, easily enough. And so larieta, which was two words. La rieta was a lariat. And lasso. So each of one of these things continued to have the same meaning, but were anglicized and thus became Western English terms that have now found their way into vocabularies in the English-speaking world in many respects.
But many of the words we associate with the West weren't really Western words at all. Cowboy, for instance, dates from at least the American Revolution and was an Eastern word. So too were chuckwagon and desperado. To bite the dust can be found in Chaucer. Bounty hunter, gunslinger, and to have an itchy trigger finger never existed in the West at all, but were the inventions of Hollywood scriptwriters. One of the inevitable side effects of America's ceaseless westward expansion was that Americans had to come up with names for everything along the way, rivers, mountains, and of course the towns they formed. Not surprisingly, given the mood of the time and the sheer volume of things to be named, quite a number of them are colorful. Places like Ding Dong in Looneyville, Texas, Bowlegs, Oklahoma, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, Tightwad, Missouri, and of course, Tombstone, Arizona. Often the more colorful names were later quietly changed for reasons that don't require elucidation, as with Two Tits, California, and Shithouse Mountain, Arizona. So great was the volume of place naming, and so rapidly were the names applied, discarded, or changed, that by the end of the 19th century, the situation was exceedingly confused. Many states had as many as 5 towns with the same name, causing constant perplexity for the postal service. Hundreds of places went by 2 or more names, or were spelled in countless different ways. Winnipesaukee, for instance, a lake in New Hampshire, has been recorded with no fewer than 200 spellings. Often it took some time before people could agree on a regular spelling. Dr. Cassidy again.
In about the 1880s, the U.S. Post Office decided that they would simplify the spelling of place names. So they decided that no place name should have more than one section. You didn't want to have something like Blue Hills or something like that. It had to be Blue Hills. And so they wrote them all together. This was for the convenience of the letter carriers, of course. And then another thing that they had was if you had something with an extra letter on the end of it, you just chopped it off. They tried to do that with Pittsburgh, and the Scots revolted. They said, Pittsburgh, it's not a German place. We don't have it ending in B-U-R-G. We keep our H. And Pittsburgh was big enough, strong enough, so that they won their case. But some of the smaller towns, which had H's on and other things like that, they were simply chopped down to essential letters.
Is there any evidence that Pittsburgh was originally pronounced Pittsburgh on analogy with Edinburgh?
Well, I'm sure that the Scots who came over still called it Pittsburgh, as in Edinburgh and all the other boroughs. I'm sure the Scots did it, but that would be one generation.
Although most of us have an image of Americans moving west by wagon train or stagecoach, it was in fact the train that peopled the American hinterlands, and it happened with incredible swiftness. From virtually nothing in 1830, America built 30,000 miles of railway line, more than all the rest of the world put together, in just 30 years. 30 years after that, America had no less than 200,000 miles of track. Railways so dominated American travel that for four generations, road meant railroads. But the role of the railways fades into insignificance compared with the form of transportation that gripped America at the start of this century and totally transformed the way the country looked, thought, and lived. I refer, of course, to the motor car. Although the car was invented in Germany, and nearly all the early technological inventions were German, the first manufacturing firms were mostly in France, which is why so many of the terms associated with motoring are French. Chassis, garage, chauffeur, carburetor, coupe, limousine, and of course, automobile itself, the word that Americans have preferred for the car since about 1905. Surprisingly, given their inventiveness in other realms, Americans made almost no significant contribution to motoring technology, particularly in the early days. Yet they made the car their own, and with a swiftness that was all but breathtaking. In 1898, the United States didn't have a single car factory. Indeed, there were fewer than 30 cars in the whole country. A decade later, the U.S. had 700 car factories and was producing 85% of all the cars in the world. In 1912, an Indianapolis businessman named Carl Graham Fisher got the idea that what America needed was a coast-to-coast highway. Since the government in Washington refused to pay for the road, it had to be built privately from the donations of people and communities along the way. Despite this handicap, in 1923, Fisher's dream was realized when the Lincoln Highway opened. Running 3,389 miles from New York to San Francisco, it was the first transcontinental highway in the world. Almost overnight, it became, as the postcards proudly boasted, America's Main Street. Mike Beckner and Lloyd Baller of Jefferson, Iowa, near the highway's midpoint, recall its heyday.
Me being in the retail gasoline business, this was a direct route, actually from Illinois, but actually Chicago, to Denver or Rocky Mountain National Park. Thousands every year traveled that, you know.
What was it like? Was it just... Was it a steady stream of cars all day long?
Oh, no. The Lincoln Highway wasn't that. During the summer, of course, there'd be probably a fairly good flow, but not a steady flow.
What about trucks?
There were a lot of trucks back then. And, of course, out here on Danger Highway.
Danger Hill.
Trucks, that's a real sharp corner and a narrow bridge. A lot of the trucks that would come down there would go off the road, go down there by the river, end up in the river.
They would crash.
Oh, yes, yeah. Uh-huh. And, of course, we had corners, and square corners, and a lot of people killed out here on Danger Hill.
And why did they build the road with so many square corners?
Well, I don't know.
Well, I wouldn't say they're square corners, well, but they were sharp.
Oh, they were exactly square corners.
So it brought a lot of business to our town, to everybody. Oh. They spent lots of dollars when they'd go through, you know.
Oh, sure.
The motels and the cafes and the service stations and the stores like Lloyd where he had auto supplies and it was handy for them.
But, of course, back then, Mike, they didn't have air conditioning and that. And in the summertime when it was real hot, they'd always they'd come through on Lincoln Highway and there'd be the courthouse. And, of course, nice shades there. They'd all stop, get in there, and have a nice time there. Cool down, you know. Yeah, that's right.
So, have a cold drink.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, lemonade or something.
Sure.
Soon, other fabled roads were springing up. The Dixie Highway, the Jefferson, the William Penn, the Pennsylvania Turnpike, Route 66. And with these sleek new roads came entirely new lifestyles. Americans needed new institutions to cater for their changing habits. Motels, drive-ins, diners, takeout restaurants, and other such establishments sprang up and engendered their own rich vocabulary, as Robert Easton recalls.
What in London would be called a caff used to be called in American parlance the greasy spoon. If you wanted to go someplace and have a quick meal and not spend a lot of money, you would go to the greasy spoon or what my mother used to call the chew and spit. In England, for example, my wife and I were used to going to a restaurant where either the waitress would come over and say, "May I ask what you would like? What may I bring you?" Or, "All right then, love. What is it? What is it then?" But when we came back to New York, in 1964, we went into quite an upmarket place, and the waitress said, "What do you want?" And if you wanted poached eggs on toast, you know, "Adam and Eve on a raft." Or if you wanted a steak well done, "Bone one." And so there was this whole thing about food. And then there's so many different ethnic kinds of food in the United States, like the long sandwich, which in different parts of the country has different names. A very long sandwich made with long flat bread and a lot of stuff in the South is a po' boy. Gonna have a po' boy. And in Philadelphia, it's called a hoagie. And in New York, it's called a hero. And there's all these different names for exactly the same food item.
In the post-war years, cars continued their relentless march through the hearts of Americans. By the mid-1950s, every car maker was turning out huge, chrome-heavy, monstrously tail-finned road beasts, cars that looked, in the words of one observer, as if they should light up and play. The style was called the forward look. The new breed of cars were given names suggesting that they were not just powerful, but barely under control. Firedome, Thunderbird, Tempest, Comet, Fury, Charger, and came with features that promised a heady mix of elegance, comfort, and fingertip control. The pampered car buyer could choose between models that offered such luxuries as comfort air ventilation, flight glow dials, pressed adjustment seats, torsion air suspension, and cruise-o-matic transmission. There was one outstanding exception to this, a car that had all the styling excesses, but a name that most people thought sounded like a farm implement.
They'll know you've arrived when you drive up in the 1958 Edsel. It is unlikely you have ever driven a car with so much real, usable power as the Edsel. And with Edsel's exclusive Teletouch drive, you drive more safely, more easily than you ever have before.
Between 1950 and 1980, the number of cars in America quadrupled as the nation took to the road as it never had before. Very little of this new motoring activity brought much benefit to the towns along the likes of the Lincoln or Dixie highways. That's because Americans had taken to new kinds of roads. In 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed into law the landmark Interstate Highway Act, inaugurating the construction of 42,500 miles of superhighway. By the early 1960s, most Americans would be able to go anywhere in the country on fast motorways that bypassed towns. Thousands of small businesses in little communities along the way never recovered from the loss of passing trade. Bob Ausberger, founder of the Lincoln Highway Preservation Society, showed me one typically forlorn community near his hometown in Iowa.
We're in the town of Grand Junction now, about 8 miles east of Jefferson. And the smaller towns were hurt more by losing Lincoln Highway traffic than like Jefferson, because Jefferson was the county seat, and I think that has tended to hold Jefferson together a little more. But if you'll notice here, we're going past down Main Street Grand Junction, and most of the stores are vacant.
Nearly every shop is derelict, empty, abandoned, signs that are broken and cracked, windows covered up with tarpaulins and pieces of plastic. It has a feeling of a place that was once pretty substantial, but is very nearly a ghost town now here in the middle of it.
One time there were probably 10 gas stations operating, and now there are just two, and they've lost all of their hardware stores, clothing stores, and typical commercial business district stores.
And this isn't just a thing in Greene County, Iowa. This is all along the Lincoln Highway, isn't it?
Right. It's definitely a part of the Midwest changing landscape. And I suspect that in the East and West, it's part of the changes also.
Despite the efforts of Bob's Preservation Society, you can travel long stretches of the Lincoln Highway and find few people under the age of 25 who know anything of the highway's former glory. Such is the pace of change and America's feeble sense of its own history. America is, in short, a country without roots. Not perhaps surprising in a country whose population was itself largely uprooted. But that is another program. One morning in the summer of 1881, President James Garfield was passing through Union Station in Washington, D.C., when a deranged gunman stepped from the crowd and calmly shot him twice with a .44 caliber revolver. The summer of 1881 was one of the sultriest in recent history. To provide some relief for the stricken president, a corps of naval engineers who specialized in ventilating mine shafts were summoned to the White House and instructed to build a cooling device. They rigged up a large iron box filled with ice salt and cloth filters which were saturated by the melting ice. A fan drew in warm air from outside, which was cooled as it passed through the filters and propelled onwards into the president's bedroom. The device was not terribly efficient. In 58 days it consumed £250,000 of ice, but it cooled the president's room to a more or less tolerable 81 degrees and stands in history as the first air conditioner. Nothing, alas, could revive the sinking president, and on the evening of September 19th, 2.5 months after he had been shot, he quietly passed away. The shooting of President Garfield, or more significantly, the response to the shooting, underlined the growing American belief that almost any problem could be solved with the judicious application of a little know-how. Know-how, the word dates from 1857, is a quintessentially American expression and something of a leitmotif for the 19th century. Thanks to it, America spawned a remarkable range of practical inventors who gave the world everything from the paperclip to the revolving door. But one man, more than any other, symbolizes the dynamism of the age, the man who was the driving force behind the phonograph, the cinema, and electric lighting, among much else, Thomas Alva Edison. Bob Rosenberg is an archivist of the Edison papers.
I think that a lot of the great inventors, whom we've never heard of from that period, people like Elisha Gray and Elihu Thompson, that most people have never heard of, were like Salieri to Mozart. They were just born at the wrong time. Edison was a lot like Mozart.
Is it fair to say that Edison, I mean, a very large part of his genius was not just that he was great at inventing, but that he was great at exploiting his inventions?
Well, he understood that an invention is more than just an idea. It's more than just a prototype. You have to be able, he learned himself when he tried to manufacture things, you had to be able to make it, and it had to be something that people could use and that wasn't going to break down. And he understood the full spectrum of invention and innovation, getting something to the market and making it successful.
Thanks in large part to the prolific efforts of Thomas Edison and fellow inventors like George Eastman and Charles Goodyear, America grew very rich very fast. Between 1850 and 1900, America's population trebled, but its wealth increased 13-fold. In 1894, it displaced Britain as the world's leading manufacturer. By the outbreak of the First World War, one quarter of all the world's wealth was in American hands. In the same period, the number of millionaires went from just 20 to over 40,000. All this was reflected in the language. Among the dozens of money-based words and expressions that entered the English language through America in the period are money bags, strike it rich, in clover, well-heeled, tycoon, which was borrowed from a Japanese word for a military commander, and living the life of Riley, which was borrowed from a popular song in which a Mr. Riley speculated on what he would do if he had $1 million. In short, America in the 19th century had every advantage any nation could hope for. Enterprising financiers, dynamic inventors and innovators, an abundance of natural resources, room for expansion, a well-developed work ethic. All it lacked was a cheap and flexible workforce. For that it needed one other element, an element that probably outweighed the importance of all the others put together. I refer to a wave of immigration. Beginning in about 1820, and for a century afterwards, America received immigrants in vast numbers. 7 million came from Germany, 5 million from Italy, over 3 million from Russia, 2.5 million from Scandinavia, and hundreds of thousands each from Greece, Portugal, Turkey, the Netherlands, China, Japan, and nearly every other country of the world. Ireland alone sent 5 million. That's 1.5 million more people than live in Ireland today. Nearly all of them settled in Boston or New York. By 1855, one person in three in New York was Irish-born. As Irish immigration eased, the slack was taken up by immigrants from southern Europe, principally Italy, and then by new waves from eastern Europe. Each new wave left its mark on the linguistic habits of the city. Dialect expert Robert Easton.
The Irish went into large urban areas. There's a huge Irish influence on the working class speech in New York. They'll say the both of yous and all three of yous. And they'll talk about the shenanigans and to put the kibosh, which was when they were going to execute somebody, the little cap they put on the condemned person was called the kibosh. And I don't want to listen to all of your malarkey. So there's a huge, even to the vowel system in New York City, people who are not of Irish ancestry, who are New York Italian or New York Jewish, will say Hong Kong and horrible, and they'll take Italian names like Rossi, they'll say Carlo Rossi, and so that ah vowel from Irish is very big in New York City speech.
The comedian George Carlin is a product of the New York linguistic melting pot.
I grew up in an Irish enclave on the western end of Black Harlem, which was also being encroached upon by the Cubans and Dominicans and Puerto Ricans from the north. This always sounds vaguely like some sort of a war setting, but it was, and it was quite okay. And so being Irish, you know, the Irish kids would talk like that. You know, it was sort of there's a New York accent that is a little younger. This one is a little younger than the one that I would associate with my father and my uncles, the older guy. The older guys would talk like this. The older guys, not only do they sound like they're older, you know, but there's something else about them. I don't know what it is. It has to do with their age, and it has to do with the era. See, I was in the Second World War now. God forbid you should have to go. Listen, if I go, I go. You know, if I have to go, it's okay. Hey, I don't care. Those are the two Irish voices that I grew up hearing. Then as I, we had a few Italians in our neighborhood, but it wasn't an Italian neighborhood, so there wasn't this real Italian accent on these fellas. And in high school, I began to hear really Italians from Italian neighborhoods. And there's, you know, there's a kind of different, you know, slight less, not the same. Now, I'm giving this guy, I'm talking now, I give him a little softness in his voice. They're not all like that. You know, some of them have a mahasha thing there. But it's like, you know, whenever I see the Martin Scorsese, a movie like that, or De Niro, you know, these guys, they talk different, you know. And they had things in the language. This is one of the things I mentioned before, is about fruit. Italians are very oral, you know. They open their mouth, either some food is going in or an opera is coming out, you know what I mean? So they're very oral. And therefore, a lot of things got named for food. Money was always beans. Bananas or clams. You got three clams, I got change of a banana. Here, give me change of six bananas here. Who's got an eggplant? The guy's arm. You see, his arm was big. He had a big muscle. It was a big like an eggplant, you know? They would always seem to reach for food-oriented figures of speech.
By the turn of this century, New York had become easily the most cosmopolitan city in the world. 80% of its 5 million inhabitants were either foreign-born or the children of immigrants. It had more Italians than Rome or Naples, more Irish than anywhere but Dublin, more Russians than Kiev. In 1908, a British immigrant named Israel Zangwill wrote a play about the immigration experience that gave Americans a term for the phenomenon. He called it the melting pot. In fact, there wasn't all that much melting, not at first anyway. Almost everywhere, immigrants settled in enclaves. Hungry Hollow, Illinois, for instance, was home to 15,000 Bulgarians, all employed by the local steel factory. Every city had neighborhoods that were exclusively Italian or Polish or Greek or Chinese. Even away from the cities, and particularly in the Midwest, towns were often overwhelmingly populated by people from a single ethnic group. My father, for instance, grew up in Iowa, just down the road from a town called Swedesburg, where, until about 1920, Swedish was the only language heard. Not far away were communities similarly dominated by Germans, Norwegians, or Danes. But by the late 1920s, English was rapidly taking over.
Welcome to the city of Pella. Pella was founded in 1847 by Dominie Hendrik Pieter Scholte, who came here with a band of 800 immigrants. They were fleeing religious persecution in the Netherlands. As you drive around Pella, you'll see lots of things that will show that the Dutch heritage and tradition has stayed prominent within the community. You'll note that the sidewalks are brick, some of the streets are brick. The buildings around town have a Dutch front motif, and that's because in the late 1960s, the community decided they wanted to maintain their Dutch heritage by restoring their buildings that had been built in the 1800s and add a Dutch motif. So we have an active Dutch front program in the community.
Beverly Graves, city clerk of Pella, Iowa, wearing her tour guide hat. Pella, a town of about 10,000 people, is not only full of Dutch-style buildings, but Dutch bakeries, Dutch restaurants, and Dutch surnames. Decorative windmills adorn the streets, and the community takes inordinate pride in its annual tulip festival. The one thing you won't much find in Pella today, however, is the Dutch language. Not even in the office of the mayor, Johnny Meninga.
Goedemiddag, hoe maakt u heet?
I don't know.
Well, the reason I asked you that was because, I mean, you're from a Dutch background. Your name is Meninga.
Absolutely.
How far back do we have to go before we find Dutch-born people in your family?
Probably to my great-grandfather. All right. And then... And I would say that they came over, and then my grandfather farmed outside of town here, and then my father moved into town, and my father and both my grandfather and father spoke Dutch, and my father can speak it and understands it, but comes to our generation and it's gone.
Why is that?
I think the lack of need to speak it and... the growth of the community. We're so many generations removed from the original ancestors that settled here.
Now, do you ever regret that? Do you ever wish, I mean, because you have this Dutch heritage, do you ever wish that you had listened when you were a kid?
Well, yes, absolutely. I feel a little distressed that I feel like in the community within a couple decades that we will lose a part of our heritage and that we will have very few people that even understand or know the language within that amount of time. And that that will be a significant amount of part of our heritage that will be gone forever.
Among Pella children, Dutch is already effectively dead.
Can grab a couple of kids.
Anybody really Dutch?
I am.
Okay, now hold on. I'll ask you a couple of questions. So what's your last name?
Kreinbrink.
Kreinbrink. Dutch name?
Mm-hmm.
And yours?
Jansen.
Anyone else?
I'm Klein. I'm small.
So do you speak any Dutch?
Just a little, not very much.
What can you say?
I can say kleine beetje. It means a little bit. And say, ik ben Misha Meitje. That means you are a lovely girl.
Oh, really?
That's all I can say.
So where did you learn that?
My grandma taught me.
Do you wish you spoke Dutch?
Not really.
No? So do you guys know any kids who speak Dutch? At all?
Not really.
No.
Nobody in Pella? No kids at all?
Anywhere? Not that I know of. I don't know.
The same story is true in hundreds of other communities across America.
Laat maar schmissen, woestel niet aan, dat wil heren, zoals ze klinkt Jiddisch. Ik heb ook nachten telefoneerd. Hier zijn ze gewend daarheen.
However, in this office in New York, Dr. Nootke Schechter and a small team of helpers are fighting to avoid the extinction of one of the New World's most vital and imperiled minority languages.
So what is the health of Yiddish?
The health of Yiddish. You want a medical report. the health is not too good. But we are not willing to... we are willing to admit that it's a patient. But we definitely dislike the continuous talk about dying and dead. Maybe I'm not typical, but still, I have a family of 4 children and 13 grandchildren. And the grandchildren speak Yiddish, let alone my children. As I said, we are not typical, but we are not the only ones. Let's say in the island of Manx, near Great Britain, 20 years ago, they had 2 speakers of the language, I read somewhere. This is a dying and dead language. But a language with hundreds of thousands of speakers in New York, in Antwerp, in Belgium, or in Jerusalem, or in, it's not a dead language, obviously. But the fact still is that Yiddish is not prospering as far as statistics is concerned. The only thing that I try to deny, it's not a dead language and not even dying. It is a threatened species, linguistically or biologically speaking. Threatened, yes, but not dying.
Where is the threat coming from?
The threat comes from assimilation. People adopt the official language of the country, whether it's English here or Spanish there or Russian over there, whatever the language happens to be.
There has always been pressure to assimilate in America, as Archibald Murray can attest. A Barbadian who came to America in the 1950s, Murray is now a leading lawyer in New York.
And you have absolutely no trace of a West Indian accent that I could hear.
I think that's true, and if I become angry, you'll discover that there is a big one there. I suppose if I have 2 drinks, you'll probably notice there's one there also. I think what has happened is somewhere, I don't know how it happened, but I tend to pick up the language in which I'm functioning. So that between college and law school, I spent 2 years in the Army. A year and a half of that was spent in the Southwest in Texas. When I came back, people said, what happened to your voice? Your language is different. And I think it was just a matter of reflecting the language of the other soldiers and other people with whom I spent that year and a half. And another year or so after coming back, it was gone.
Now, did you find yourself under any kind of subtle pressure to conform in terms of your speech? Did you find Americans sort of like you to have a standardized speech? Does that exist?
Yeah, I don't know that I necessarily experienced it, but I did see people sort of being pressured in a way by somebody making fun of their accent or suggesting that speaking the language they spoke and the way they spoke it was something less than good American culture.
Donaldo Macedo, a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, is a native of the former Portuguese African colony of Cape Verde, but has lived in the United States since he was 15. He has become an outspoken campaigner for immigrant rights.
When Portugal was an empire, it had Angola, Mozambique, you know, Guinea-Bissau, you know, East Timor, and Cape Verde, for instance. And we all had Portuguese passports. And yet when we arrived in Boston as Portuguese, you see, Cape Verdeans went to Roxbury, which is the black section of town, and Portuguese went to Cambridge. But how did they know before even emigrating that there was such a thing as Roxbury or Cambridge, other than that here, it was very clear that if you're not white, Portuguese, you couldn't live in Cambridge. So you lived in Dorchester or you lived in Roxbury, or you went to New Bedford. And if you went into New...
You say couldn't. You mean that it would be uncomfortable for you?
Extremely uncomfortable. You wouldn't have the community resources. You would not have the support. You would have the discrimination in school. You'd have the Portuguese community discriminated against, you know, the Portuguese of color. I have never seen the high level of xenophobia as it is exhibited right now in Boston, or the outright racism by talk radio shows, by television, by politicians, by even teachers that feel almost a certain pride in being racist under the rubric of defending the tradition, under the rubric of being conservative. And I often ask them, what the hell are you conserving? Are you bigotry? Is that something that you want to conserve? Racism? Inequality? Ghettos? Slavery, you know, and then, you know, they look at me startled, and that's part of the problem. That's why they don't want the debate, because you ask these hard questions, you know.
And do people still speak Portuguese at home?
The first generation, second generation, by third generation, then it drops off.
Why is that? I mean, that's the general pattern throughout American history. Why?
Yes, it is, because if you really think of the language policy and the type of... laws which have been implemented throughout the U.S. history, regulating both the instruction of foreign language on one hand, on the other hand, making sure that English is the only official language of the country. There are, for instance, school systems. There were school systems in the Southwest that you could be expelled from school if you were caught speaking Spanish in the hallway or in the cafeteria or in the schoolyard. And then also the myths that accompany that if you speak English, you're going to be successful. If you speak English, you're going to be accepted. If you speak English, then you're going to, quote-unquote, make it. But no matter how well you speak English, for instance, you're an African-American person who, you know, African-Americans have spoken English all their lives, and yet the certain communities they cannot walk through or they cannot drive through without being harassed. So English is not a guarantee, although they claim it is, for success.
For the most part, however, those immigrants who could do so enthusiastically embraced American life, indeed sometimes effectively remythologized it. Nowhere was this more true than in a sleepy town in Southern California that until the second decade of this century most Americans had never heard of. I refer to Hollywood. It's a curious fact that this most American of phenomena was created almost entirely by non-Americans. Consider the backgrounds of the first Hollywood moguls. Louis B. Mayer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was originally a scrap merchant from Lithuania. The Hungarian-born Adolf Zukor of famous player studios was a janitor and later a furrier. William Fox, whose real name was Wilhelm Fried, was likewise Hungarian and had worked in the garment industry before forming Fox Studios. Samuel Goldwyn was a glove salesman from Poland. Carl Lemley, founder of Universal, was a German-born immigrant who had run a clothing store in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Joseph Schenck, creator of 20th Century Productions, was a Russian-born fairground showman. The Warner brothers, Albert, Harry, Jack, and Sam, were from Poland and had mostly worked in menial jobs. Despite, or perhaps because of, their backgrounds, these men had an almost touching devotion to their adopted language. Beverly Hills-based film historian Mark Wanamaker.
The main thing that the studios and these moguls were very interested in is presenting their films, which are going to be done in English and spoken in English, would be done properly. In other words, the English had to be spoken properly. Many of the actors that were in the silent era had terrible voices or had accents or did not speak English really properly. At this time, between 1928 to 1930, every English actor that had a decent voice and could speak proper English was immediately cast into almost every film possible. They worked and worked and worked. The American actors who were trained in New York and were in England a lot, people like the Barrymores, for example, were always in demand. I mean, they were like wonderful stage actors with wonderful voices and spoke perfect English, because the immigrants who came to this country, and especially the moguls, were embarrassed about the way they spoke. So Samuel Goldwyn believed, like many of the others, like Mayer and Lemley, all of them, that there should be proper English, not the way they spoke English. So the elegance of English was important to them.
And this proper English was deemed to be a sort of British English or East Coast American English?
At the beginning, the proper standards for English would be based on British standards. And that's why they would hire English actors to act in the films, because they considered that to be the proper way of speaking. It was not East Coast English particularly that was the way of being spoken. The East Coast English, the real East Coast English, would be Brooklynized, would be Connecticut, a Bostonian type of English, which had a definite accent to it, which was extremely identifiable as being American, but not the proper American that they thought the standard should be. It should be English English, even with a little accent saying, you know, with your ahs instead of a's, things like this. They really believed in that.
As outsiders, the studio moguls saw America as no Americans could, and they reshaped America's image of itself by making films that were wholesome, patriotic, and by and large, ferociously pro-American.
The studios, particularly Louis B. Mayer of MGM, was very concerned about the condition of the country. They were very politically minded, by the way. Most of these, they were liberal moguls and the conservative moguls. All of them, though, agreed on one thing, that there was a danger in America of losing American identity in some way, and which is very different from these days. These days, nowadays, people want their own cultures, want their own languages, and this and that. In those days, these moguls who came from other countries did not want that. They wanted more of an American society. The way of doing this would be to show films that dealt with American values, American culture, American families. What were these American communities? Well, the basis of that was the Norman Rockwell paintings of the time, which had to do with the farmers, the pioneers. That's why they made films about the West and the settling of the West, the pioneering values of these people.
The image of America created by Hollywood found a willing audience, not just in the United States, but in the world. American culture was about to go global. But that's another program. I'm standing outside the old Monadnock building in Chicago. Built in 1891 and rising just 17 stories, it is lost among the forest of soaring structures that fill the Chicago skyline. but in its day it was a wonder. No brick building had ever been built this high. Indeed, few were even half as tall. That's because brick is a stubbornly dense and heavy material. Really tall buildings required a whole series of new technologies, and it was here in Chicago, in the late 19th century, that most of these new technologies were first brought together. The result was a new type of building with a new name, the skyscraper. One of the technological innovations skyscrapers required was fast and efficient elevators, and nowhere is the need for that more apparent than three blocks away in the tallest building so far built, the famous Sears Tower.
You're now riding in one of the world's fastest elevators. In 70 seconds, you'll reach the sky deck on the 103rd floor of Sears Tower. The sky deck is 1,353 feet above ground.
The view, of course, is spectacular. I am literally above the clouds. To the east, Lake Michigan. In every other direction, acres of boundless prairie. So why on earth did they build these massive edifices in such a spacious place? The answer, of course, is because they could. Throughout the 19th century, Americans found their lives repeatedly transformed by new developments. Not just the skyscraper, but the telegraph, the steam train, the telephone, the cable car, and electricity. In the second half of the century particularly, the way they worked, lived, shopped, traveled, and exchanged ideas underwent a revolution, as the historian Robert Rosenberg notes.
Probably the biggest change in this country happened between 1800 and 1850. In 1800, you expected to live the way your grandparents did. And in 1850, you knew you weren't going to. The railroad and the telegraph had just changed the way people thought about the way they lived, and change was becoming the norm instead of a static culture, a static society.
When people think of the great innovations of the 19th century, they tend to think of large factories and big industrial processes. But in fact, there was one new development that was, in a social sense, perhaps even more important. I refer to a revolutionary new phenomenon that came to be known as the department store. It began in 1846 when an enterprising Irish-born immigrant named Alexander Stewart opened a business called the Marble Dry Goods Palace on Broadway in New York. Stewart's idea was to offer the customer everything he or she could want under a single roof, something that seems obvious now but had never been tried before, and it thrived as no retail enterprise ever had. Within a half a dozen years, Stewart's store covered a whole block and had a staff of 2,000. Soon department stores were sprouting in every large American city. Wanamaker's in Philadelphia, Jordan Marsh in Boston, Macy's in New York. They transformed the shopping experience for millions of Americans. Compared with previous retail establishments, these new bazaars were airy, spacious, and marvelously self-contained. Department stores offered millions their first look at wonders of the age, like the passenger lift, electric lighting, public telephones, and escalators, the last so novel and giddying that when they were first introduced, some stores stationed nurses at the top to minister to those made lightheaded by the experience. By the turn of the century, the department store's services were almost boundless. They had post offices, branch libraries, lost and found departments, hair salons, roof gardens, first aid stations, restrooms, tea rooms, information bureau, and other diversions. Department stores became the main place to view wondrous new consumer items like the phonograph and carpet sweeper. Sometimes these new products took off with amazing rapidity. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell, a Scotsman living in Boston, invented a product so revolutionary that at first people weren't even sure what to call it. Many referred to it as a speaking telegraph. Bell himself referred to it as a new kind of telegraphy, before settling on the phrase electrical speaking telephone. Shortened simply to telephone, the new device sold in the thousands, 60,000 in the first 4 years alone, 6 million in the first 20 years. And soon all kinds of new phone-inspired expressions were creeping into the language. Yellow pages, operator, phone book, I'll call you. Such was the novelty of the new device that at first people weren't sure what to say in response to a ringing phone. Thomas Edison thought callers should respond with a jaunty ahoy, and that was the answer used by the world's first telephone operator, one George Coy of New Haven, Connecticut. Others, however, said yes or what, and many merely picked up the receiver and listened hopefully. The problem was such that magazines ran long articles explaining the etiquette of phone use. Time after time, people invented, manufactured, and marketed objects without having any idea of whether people might actually want them. Museums all over America are full of dazzling late 19th century consumer items, as I found when I met Robert Rosenberg at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington.
Now we're standing in front of the original. Is this the original?
No, but it's an 1878 phonograph made by Sigmund Bergman, who had been an associate of Edison's for some time and had a shop in New York City. And Edison had him make a number of these machines to be sold. I'm trying to remember the price. I think these sold for around somewhere between $100 and $200. I'm not sure this exact model what it sold for.
And that would be like thousands of dollars in today's money?
It was, yes. Yes, they were expensive.
Now, what did Edison have in mind for it?
Well, the phonograph was a very odd invention because it was almost the only Edison invention that fell completely out of the sky. It was a complete surprise to Edison when he invented it and realized what he had invented. Something like the electric light or his telegraph inventions were something that he had thought about and he had approached deliberately because he knew there was a market. For the phonograph, it was just this fantastic novelty and people seemed to want them. He got letters begging for them, but in fact, they had no practical utility in their early years.
It seemed not to matter what a product did or how much it cost. If it was novel enough, people simply had to have it. Nowhere was this more true than with a little box camera invented in 1888 by George Eastman, a junior bank clerk in Rochester, New York. Before Eastman came along, photography was a cumbersome business, involving large boxes on tripods and much fussing with wet and dry plates. So Eastman's little camera, just 6.5 inches long, was a marvel. He called it a Kodak. The name meant nothing, but Eastman liked the sound of it and thought, rightly, that it would stick in people's minds. Eastman's Kodak cost $25, 5 times the average weekly wage, and each roll of film cost $10, including developing. Moreover, the pictures were small, just 2.5 inches across, and of not very good quality. Even so, Eastman sold 100,000 of his cameras in the first 5 years of business, and soon people everywhere were talking about snapshots, originally a British shooting term, incidentally. Eastman developed 3 crucial strategies that have been the hallmarks of virtually every successful consumer goods company ever since. First, he went for the mass market, reasoning that it was better to make a little money each from a lot of people rather than a lot of money from a relative few. Second, he showed a tireless, obsessive dedication to making his products better and cheaper. In the 1890s, such an approach was widely perceived as insane. If you had a successful product, you milked it for all it was worth. You certainly didn't create new products that made your existing lines obsolescent. Eastman did. But above all, what set Eastman apart was the lavishness of his advertising. He spent a fortune on advertising, $750,000 in a single year, an unheard of sum. Moreover, it was good advertising, crisp, catchy, reassuringly trustworthy. Eastman's first cameras were so primitive and unreliable that the users couldn't be trusted to take the film out themselves. Instead, they had to send the whole camera to the lab. Eastman's first ads brilliantly made a virtue of this shortcoming. You press the button, we do the rest, they boasted. Kodak's success with the masses did not escape other businessmen. Previously, manufacturers had concentrated their marketing efforts on retailers. Now they went straight for the consumer. In consequence, Americans not only shopped more, but they began to shop in an entirely different way. They looked for brand names. It's no accident that many of our most enduring brand names date from this period. Heinz sauces, Kellogg's Corn Flakes, Gillette razor blades, Wrigley's chewing gum, Campbell's soup, and Coca-Cola. as products fought to build an identity, advertising budgets soared. A catchy slogan became all. Many of America's most venerable advertising slogans date from this period. When it rains, it pours. The pause that refreshes. The beer that made Milwaukee famous. Say it with flowers. The great thing about a slogan was that it didn't have to be accurate to be effective. Heinz never actually had 57 varieties of anything. The catchphrase arose simply because H.J. Heinz, the company's founder, decided he liked the sound of the number. Undeterred by considerations of verity, he had the slogan slapped on every one of the company's products. By the 1890s, advertising was appearing everywhere. In newspapers and magazines, on billboards, on the sides of buildings, on streetcars, on paper bags, even on matchbooks, which were invented in 1892 and were being extensively used as an advertising medium within 3 years. As Americans took increasingly to the road, advertisers went with them. One company called Burmashave became famous for its roadside signs. Members of the Lincoln Highway Preservation Society in Iowa recall them.
Burmashave was
shaving cream,
and I suppose the company that owned them probably had this idea. And they would post out along Lincoln Highway because it was the most traveled highway, and more people would read these signs, and they'd end up always saying Burmashave, buy Burmashave, see.
What was the idea? Didn't the signs have kind of little catchy rhymes?
Oh yeah, all of them did.
Were they always witty?
Yes.
Oh yeah,
yeah, all of them. Yeah, yeah. Right. All of them were witty.
I can't think what they said. Do you, Bob?
Oh, well, they wouldn't say anything. Only like,
well, no, they said three or four things along on the signs. I can't remember what they did say.
Oh, guys, I can't remember any of them.
One East Jefferson said, "Spring has sprung and grass has riz where last year's careless driver is."
Oh, is that right? That was good. Yeah, that's, it all,
it but didn't they change them from time to time? Or was that
right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They change them. You bet. Yeah, they change them.
Oh, yes.
They had agreements with farmers, and the farmers would get a small gift each year for having the Burmashave signs on their ground.
Oh, they must have literally
thousands of those signs, I'd say, those signs across the country. See, yes.
There's another one here we've got in this book. I wonder if you two could read it to me.
There. Over.
That one there.
Oh, this one here says, "Past schoolhouses, take it slow. Let the little shavers grow. Burmashave."
Yeah. Oh, this is a good one.
Oh, right there.
You read it, Lloyd. Around the curve.
Around? No, the curve.
No, around.
Around the curve. Lickety-split. It's a beautiful car, wasn't it?
Yep.
So he must have had an accident,
yeah,
see?
Sure. But they were all catchy like
oh,
that.
Oh, yes. It was good.
And they had literally must have been hundreds of them.
Oh,
and everybody seemed to get a kick out of reading them. As you can see, they're rather catchy little sayings, you know. And that company, Burmashave, must have really sold a lot of merchandise from those signs, seeing that name so much.
Yeah.
And then people from all over the United States, they'd read those Burmashave, and probably people had never heard of Burmashave.
Oh, sure.
They'd say, "Gee whiz, what's that?" They'd say, "Burmashave."
The early signs, they had trouble with the horses eating the signs.
Oh.
In the farmers' pastures.
Was they made of wood?
They were made of wood, yeah.
And the horse, he liked to chew on.
So they had to put them on taller posts.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
"Does your husband misbehave? Grunt and grumble, rant and rave.
Oh.
Shoot the brute some Burmashave." They're clever little...
Yeah, they're good little...
they're really good.
Sure.
I think that would be great advertising.
Oh,
if I sold Burmashave, I'll tell you I would.
The signs remained a feature of American roadsides until the early 1960s, by which time advertisers were selling not just products, but concepts.
"You can make your family's life much brighter. You will find your work much lighter. It's as easy as can be to live better electrically. You can have..."
In short, advertising had become huge business, and it has stayed that way ever since. Indeed, these days, advertising is practically inescapable. It's been estimated that by the time he is 18, the average American child will have been exposed to 350,000 television commercials.
Introducing a new generation of Toyotas, the FX16. You gotta drive it to believe it.
As Northern Virginia continues to grow, Providence Savings continues to grow too, with 9 convenient locations serving Northern Virginia. Find out why we say we do it with interest.
Mitsubishi presents the sports car that's charged with more than a turbo. The Cordia, an electrifying new sports coupe. The Tredia, a sedan that conquered time and space.
Difficult as it may be to believe, some people are convinced that most Americans actually like it this way. Helen Verstandig, a former advertising executive and founder of a direct marketing company called Wellington.
People in this country want commercials. They listen to commercials. They want it. And it's very important to their economy. Advertising, that I know a great deal about. If you go into the history of advertising in this country, advertising really is tied in totally with the economic growth. Whether it was the automotive industry, whether it was the food industry, you name it.
But why do you say people want advertising?
Almost any research on newspaper, take the New York Times, which editorially speaking is great, right?
Mm-hmm.
They buy it for the ads. Look at the mail order business in America. When I started Wellington, I started as a mail order simulated diamond business. We called it the counterfeit diamond. When I did my first marketing test after I discovered the type of market we were after, I took a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal as a test and got 20,000 leads for a brochure, which has to tell you something about the Wall Street Journal and its readership.
How seriously do you think people are influenced by ads?
Very much so.
So does it make America a greedy country?
No, I think it makes it a wonderful country because of the choice. You have choices here.
But is it possible that people who can't afford to buy all these wonderful things are given a sense of discontent from being constantly bombarded with advertising, do you think?
That's hard for me to believe. You can look at it in two ways. You can say that someone's looking at an ad for Cadillac and says, I can't afford it, I can only buy a Ford. On the other hand, that same person can look at that ad and say, someday if I work hard, I can own a Cadillac. It's the American dream.
The speed of American life, the desire for novelty and for instant gratification, and the constant siren song of advertising all left Americans with a restless need to constantly consume. Lavish choice became the norm and remains so, as here in Chicago.
Welcome to the world's busiest Bennigan's. My name is Tony. I'll be your waiter for today. Got some great things to tell you about. Just to get you started, first of all, our appetizer for today is Bennigan's Best Sampler Platter. We get it out to you. It's with potato skin, fried cheese, and chicken wings. Our entree right now is Cajun chicken pasta. It's fresh strips of chicken with little Cajun seasoning, vegetables, and fettuccine noodles.
Bennigan's continues a trend which began in the 19th century when there arose a new breed of office worker who needed meals in a hurry. In short order, beginning in about 1872, Americans got diners, lunch counters, lunch wagons, luncheonettes, cafeterias, automats, self-service restaurants, and short order restaurants, all places where one could acquire a quick, cheap, and usually greasy meal. The first place known to be called a cafeteria opened in Chicago in the 1890s, and the idea took off in a big way, though for many years the word was often pronounced in the Spanish style, cafeteria. Cafeterias proved so popular, in fact, that they spawned a huge vogue for words of similar form. Washateria, grosseteria, cakeateria, shaveateria, smoketeria, hardwareateria, buteria, chocolateria, furnitureteria, and at least one casketeria for a funeral home. Luncheonette, an alternative form, likewise spawned a number of words ending in "-ette." Kitchenette, usherette, roomette, bachelorette, and drum majorette, among many others. To satisfy the demand created by this new kind of market, restaurants needed food that was cheap, tasty, quick to eat, and easy to fix. Fast, portable food already had something of a tradition in America. The hot dog had been around since the early 1800s, though no one called it that. It was a frankfurter or wiener. Then in about 1900, a popular cartoonist named Tad Dorgan drew a picture of a dachshund in an elongated bun, called it a hot dog, and the term stuck. Because of the implied connection with dog meat, manufacturers never liked the name and persisted with advertising campaigns that studiously avoided the expression.
We admire wieners, Oscar Mayer wieners, the best you ever put in buns.
Was there the juicy, all-meat one.
Whether they called them wieners, hot dogs, or red hots, they soon became the staple diet of spectators at baseball games. Nothing, however, better satisfied the need for new types of quick food than a sandwich that came into being at about the same time as diners and lunch counters. I refer, of course, to that most quintessential of American dishes, the hamburger. Nobody knows where the first hamburger was made or why it was called a hamburger, since there has never been any ham in the hamburger and there's no tradition of making such a sandwich in Hamburg. All that can be said for sure is that the word hamburger is first recorded in the February 16, 1884 edition of the Boston Journal, and that it caught on very quickly, which is a bit surprising, since in its early days the hamburger was often regarded by short-order cooks as a convenient way of passing off old or doubtful meat. Others made the meat go further by adding cereal. In short, some hamburgers were good and some were terrible. To rectify this required the vision of two brothers from New Hampshire, who, like millions of other Americans, went west during the Depression years and settled in California. Their names were Richard and Maurice McDonald, and they ran a hamburger stand, how apt this now seems, at the very end of Route 66 in San Bernardino near Los Angeles. It was a conventional hamburger stand, and it made good money. But, like all hamburger stands, it was labor-intensive. Every time a customer arrived, a car hop had to go to his car, take his order, and convey the order to the kitchen, where the food would be specially cooked and the meal conveyed to the hungry customer on a tray. When the customer had eaten, the car hop had to come back to his car to take his tray and settle his bill before he could leave. Then the tray had to be taken back to the kitchen and the plates and cutlery washed. It was all inefficient and time-consuming. In the spring of 1948, the McDonald brothers were seized with a vision. They shut their hamburger stand for 3 months, sacked the 20 car hops, got rid of all the china and cutlery, and reopened with a new, entirely novel concept, that the customer would have to come to a window to collect the food rather than have it brought to the car. They cut the menu to just 4 items, hamburgers, cheeseburgers, pie, and potato crisps, plus milk, coffee, and soda pop. Customers no longer specified what they wanted on their hamburgers, but received them ready-made with ketchup, mustard, onions, and pickle. The change was a flop. The teenagers on whom they had relied went elsewhere. But gradually, a new type of clientele developed, the family, particularly after the brothers added French fries and milkshakes to the menu. Before long, business was booming. The McDonald's constantly refined the process to make the production of food more streamlined and efficient. With a local machine shop owner named Ed Toman, they invented almost everything connected with the production of fast food, from dispensers that pump out a precise dollop of ketchup or mustard to the Lazy Susans on which 24 hamburger buns can be simultaneously dressed. In 1954, Ray Kroc, a seller of milkshake machines, bought the franchise rights from the brothers and began the business of turning McDonald's into an international empire. Kroc achieved his goal in large part by making sure that the formula of the original McDonald's in San Bernardino was followed everywhere with the most exacting fidelity. His obsession with detail became legendary. He dictated that McDonald's burgers must be exactly 3.875 inches across, weigh 1.6 ounces, and contain 19% fat. He even specified how many sesame seeds should go on each Big Mac bun. The result was that soon there were hundreds of McDonald's all over America, and each one of them was exactly identical to every other. Soon the trick was being extended to other commercial enterprises.
Can I have a Whopper cheese, a Big Fish sandwich, two large french fries, and two coffees?
That's right.
888, second window, please.
Before long, Americans had become the world's experts at replicating experiences. Wherever you went in the world, you could count on getting the same hamburger, the same hotel room, the same soft drink, the same everything. The ultimate manifestation of this commercial cloning syndrome is the shopping mall. Mall shopping has become the nation's biggest leisure time activity. Americans spend, on average, 12 hours a month at shopping malls, more than they devote to almost any activity but sleeping, eating, working, and watching television. There are 20,000 large shopping centers in America, and a new one opens every 7 hours. Today there are shopping malls everywhere. There's a shopping mall in a New Hampshire hospital, where, presumably, you can go in for surgery without having to undergo the terrible trauma of shopping withdrawal. There's even a shopping mall here at the Caesars Palace Casino in Las Vegas. It is altogether fitting, I suppose, that there should be a mall here in a casino, since Las Vegas is surely the apotheosis of the American consumer experience. A place that is full of seductive noise and glitter and bright lights and machines that take your money without dispensing a product. You can, in effect, shop till you drop without the bother and inconvenience of acquiring lots of bulky packages. This may be the wave of the future, as we'll examine. But for that, we need another program.
It's hot, it's exciting. 21, it's you against the dealer. Do you hit or do you stay? Baccarat, the elegant continental way to gamble. Keno, as easy as bingo, but a lot more fun.
Who throws the dice and how long do they get to keep them?
Well, let's experiment here. So you've made a $10 pass line. You're going to pick up two dice that you like out of six. So those are the two dice you like.
Like these two, please.
And you're going to roll them the longest distance at the table.
This is the gambling lab of the University of Las Vegas in Nevada. Here, Jim Kilby, the world's first full-time professor of gambling, teaches future casino managers everything from the psychology of crowd flow to the intricacies of playing craps. I've come to learn craps.
This is what they call a come-out roll, so go ahead. 7 or 11, you win. 2, 3, or 12, you lose. A 5, that's not a 7 or 11. You didn't win. That's not a 2, 3, or 12. You didn't lose. So what the dealer does, he moves this over to the 5, which means that that bet wins if a 5 is rolled before a 7. And you are the shooter. Same shooter.
So as long as I get a 5 before a 7, I'm...
You win. 7 before a 5, you lose. It's crap too, but it means nothing on the pass line. Now, had someone bet the field, they would have won that.
Now, tell me, Jim, 20 years ago, Las Vegas and Reno were the only real gambling places in the States.
That's right.
Now, they've even got gambling in my hometown, Des Moines, Iowa. You can go everywhere there's
casinos. Are you from Des Moines?
I'm from Des Moines.
Is that real? Yeah. You don't have a Des Moines accent.
I know.
It's amazing, the gambling. I quote H.R. Haldeman. He made the comment during the Watergate affair that it's tough to get toothpaste back in the tube, and that's much like gaming right now. And it's just the aging of America. The customer today doesn't have the the same attitude toward gambling that our parents did. Whenever I came to Nevada from Oklahoma back in the late '60s. Gambling was bad. That's just stuff that bad people do. But nowadays, it's just gone mainstream. And I think now we see gambling as entertainment. Back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, it was seen as a vice.
Gambling has become a huge business in America. Casino gambling alone is worth $30 billion a year, more than the combined turnover of movies, books, and recorded music. Add in all the other forms of legal gambling, lotteries, bingo, horse racing, and so on, and the amount rises to over $300 billion a year. This in a country where 20 years ago, nearly all forms of gambling were illegal in most places.
You see, what today's casino manager, what they try to do is provide everything that you want. You want church, you got it. You want cheap meals, you got it. You want to get married in our place, here's our chapel. Whatever you want, we got it. And if we don't have it and there's a demand for it, we'll soon get it.
There's just one thing I want, and that's to roll off.
You got it. Well, all you need is a five.
Five before seven. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Show us a five here, so at least you're.
And how much? Oh. How much money is this? I've got
you're
right.
You're going to win all of $10. You'll be even for last night. Well, that's the point you didn't want to see.
I got
seven out, lying away. You lost. That's it. You want to see a five before seven, and you saw a seven before five, and that's how easy it is.
Story of my life.
For super high rollers, whales as they're known in the trade, some hotels put aside special rooms, decorated in the opulent style that might be known as Las Vegas excessive, as at the giant Las Vegas Hilton, where I met Lee Skelly, the hotel's vice president.
This room is for players that don't really want to be in the public eye. They're premium customers that play in this casino as well as a few other casinos in Las Vegas. But most of the casinos in Nevada would not even want this type of customer because of the volatility of their play. These customers are attracted here not through direct mail, which is what is the standard in the business today for the masses. These customers are attracted by one-on-one marketing.
Now, what would I have to do to come up to gain admission to this room? Have a reputation?
No. The minimum that you would have to put up to play in this room is $1 million. And the minimum that you'd have to play is $10,000 a hand.
Serious money, isn't
it? Yes, that's serious money. Yes, it is.
Now, I mean, these guys just come up here on their own, or have they got a party of people with them, or how does it work? Do they arrange with friends to all meet here at a particular time?
Usually the people that play in this room, they have a baccarat table to themselves.
One person?
One person.
It sounds awful lonely.
It's not really as much of a social function for these customers as it is for the other 99% of our business.
And how many people like this are there in the world?
We probably market to about 200 customers on a one-on-one basis that would qualify to play in this room.
The average family spends $65 to $90 per day on gambling in Vegas, about the same as they would spend at Disneyland. To them, it is, as Jim Kilby says, an entertainment, effectively another kind of theme park. Because it has only recently become perceived as a mainstream entertainment, most Americans are in fact novice gamblers. Though standing on the Strip in Las Vegas, where 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, crowds shuffle between garish outsized casinos and a score of the largest hotels in America, you would never guess that these people are learners. Indeed, here, amidst the most concentrated eruption of glitz on the planet, you could be excused for thinking that this must be the most morally relaxed and emancipated nation in the world. How very wrong you would be. Elsewhere, America remains rooted to its puritanical foundations to an extraordinary degree. This is a country where a newspaper like the New York Times, generally perceived to be the most sophisticated and worldly of American daily papers, won't accept an ad for a movie called Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and where a serious and learned publication like the Columbia Journalism Review can run a long article on a controversy involving the expression kiss my ass without actually using the expression. Words and phrases that would not raise an eyebrow elsewhere in the English-speaking world retain a rare power to scandalize in America. Even relatively mild epithets like hell or damn are routinely purged from most of the nation's press. So you can imagine what happens when there is some real swearing. Actually, you don't need to imagine. Here is Tommy Lasorda, manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team, as broadcast on television during one of his more outspoken moods.
What's your opinion of King's performance?
What's my opinion of King's performance? What the f*** you think is my opinion of it? I think it was put that in. I don't opinion of his performance. He beat us with three home runs. I'm f***ed off to lose a game. And you ask me my opinion of his performance.
And yet in private, Americans swear at least as robustly as people in other nations, perhaps more so. This is the mailroom at North Adams State College in Massachusetts. This may sound like everyday chatter to you, but to Timothy Jay, a professor of psychology at the college who made these recordings, this is work. Jay studies how Americans swear, which words they use, and how often they use them. He's America's leading authority on swearing and author of the definitive study on the matter. The way Americans swear, he believes, tells us a great deal about the society in which they live. For years, Jay was forbidden by his dean from carrying out his studies on the grounds that it was too controversial, which tells us something more about American society. I asked him whether he found it difficult to discuss his work on radio or television, given prevailing attitudes.
I would say it's not difficult. I would say it's impossible to talk about what I want to do. I'll give you an ironic example of standards. I did two different radio interviews. On one interview in Denver, right before I came on, they were doing the news. They were talking about a man who had been decapitated by a train. And they gave a fair amount of details about what had happened. In another interview in Pittsburgh, before I came on, was a long and elaborate story about a priest who was sodomizing young boys at rest stops. Yet, after they do these grisly news stories, they tell me I'm not allowed to use a word like fart on the radio. We can talk about people being decapitated or sodomized. So they can... He says to me, oh, we can do this in, we can talk about the decapitation or the sodomizing because it's in clinical terms. Now, my question to them, why can't we talk about language in clinical terms? I have spent my whole career doing this. I have a PhD. I've done tons of research on this. Why can't we just use a variety of language to talk about things you're already talking about in the abstract? But every interview that I have done in every medium has been censored, no question. They will either refer to what I said. I was in a federal court on a court case involving a woman who had called a police officer an asshole. And so they would say that it involved a derogatory term for men or a reference to the derriere, as if we can insult the French here, but we can't insult the English. So. They use euphemisms, they use circumlocutions, you know, various ways to get around it, or they will use the first initial, and depends on what the policy is in the newspaper.
Where are the boundaries of acceptability here? I mean, now you
depends
know,
on the publication. Depends
but generally speaking, I mean, looking at a local newspaper, what words can go in? Or when you were doing your radio interviews, you say you can't use fart. What words, how far could you go?
You could use anything they used on primetime television, damn, hell, bitch, slut, whore, pig, nigger.
So you can use nigger?
Yeah, which is... I noticed. I was looking at some of the British standards, and now that term is way up at the top. But you get the ethnic words, especially if you're watching movies about gangs and gang violence, you'll get that. Which is odd. Why are you allowed to derogate women and use words that derogate African-Americans, but you're not allowed to use... terms for body parts, body products.
So it
doesn't make sense.
That's very strange.
I mean, there's a lot of hard questions about looking back at how people use this language because it has been censored and ignored for so long. It's hard to tell.
How do you do research? Because I mean, so little of it is going to be in print. I mean, anyone trying to do research into swearing in America in the 20th century, 2 centuries from now, will have very little hard data to go by, won't they?
That's right. And almost all the written and recorded documents up through World War II have all been censored. So it's hard to tell what the common. I mean, when we're talking about cursing, we're talking about something that's very common with the common person. And they didn't read, write, they didn't leave recordings of their language. We have no idea what the pilgrims really talked about or what a conversation sounded like in a bar or how the cowboys talked. And they had to be swearing because if they didn't swear, the language wouldn't be here with us now. So we probably have a lot of, you think about the pilgrims wearing these gray outfits and starched white shirts and, you know, that's probably very inaccurate. As inaccurate as the way we think about them talking, because what we have left for recordings is polite but inaccurate.
The inherent absurdities of attitudes to swearing inspired the comic George Carlin to write a celebrated sketch on 7 words you can't say on television.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7. Bad word. That's what they told us they were, remember?
That's a bad word.
No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions and words. You know the 7, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit.
Delicacy forbids us from going any further. However, let the record show that on Radio 4, I could probably get away with at least 4 of these words without attracting sackfuls of complaints. But in America, these 7 words created more than a little trouble for George Carlin.
It came about by a radio station in New York, Pacifica Radio Station, WBAI, playing that record on the air, the routine called Filthy Words, which was actually the sequel to 7 Words You Can Never Say on TV. It came out in a later album. They played it on the air on a listener-supported station. They warned the audience about it. They played it in the context of a show that was about language restrictions, and yet they got this one complaint in New York City, a market of, well, probably 50 million radios if you count all the cars and workplaces. One complaint from a professional moral person, someone, a member of Morals in Media, went to the FCC. They fined the station. The station refused the fine, took them to court, took the FCC to court, beat them at the district level. The FCC then kicked it up to the Supreme Court in October 1978. It was a 5-4 decision against the radio station. These words were deemed indecent. It was a new category of filth created especially for my list. There was no indecent language in law before that. Now we have obscene and indecent. So I added a whole category. And I think it's just so much wonderful nonsense, you know, that it's a funny point of perverse pride.
Do you have any idea why it is? I mean, one of the mystifying things to outsiders about America, I think, is that in so many areas of human existence, it leads the world. But when it comes to things like morality, it's always, you know, I mean, you can go to any beach in Italy and the women will be bathing topless. I mean, this is a Catholic country.
Yeah.
You can open newspapers in Britain and there will be swear words.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to how you conduct yourself in public, America is very, very much more restrictive. Do you have any idea why that would be?
Well, you know, you mentioned that Italy is a Catholic country. But the United States is a puritanical country. I mean, it's not just a Christian or Judeo-Christian or a Christian republic, which I claim it to be, but it is a special strain of Protestantism, of puritanical, the control of others' behavior. Very important. So there's this need to correct the behavior of others, and there is this puritanical attitude toward the body. It's a terrible, terrible thing because it's a form of self-hatred, I think. To hate one, to be suspicious of the body and fear some of the body. And you know, sex is the very thing that creates life. the very two of the most natural, irresistible forces in nature are having to go to the bathroom and having to procreate your own species. Irresistible. These two things are the things we've decided to resist. It's amazing to me.
In recent years, discussions have moved beyond the question of what Americans say to the question of in which language they may say it. The growing preponderance of non-English speakers in places like Florida and California has led increasingly to calls for English to be made the official language of the United States. Many Americans, particularly in areas heavily populated by immigrants from the Spanish-speaking world, feel that they are being swamped. In two of America's largest cities, Los Angeles and Miami, more than half of all residents have Spanish as their mother tongue. In America as a whole, there are now over 200 Spanish-language newspapers, 200 radio stations, and 300 TV stations. Many find this trend alarming. Among them, G. Gordon Liddy, the talk show host.
The theory used to be that we had the melting pot. We all came from one place or another. We attempted to learn the common language and to use it. And indeed, before one could become formally a naturalized citizen, one had to be able to discuss the Constitution in the English language. And I think that was good.
And what is the situation now?
Well, the situation now is that they'll send out brochures on how to vote and everything in Spanish and this and that. And there's some schools where they've got something like some school system, 70, 80 different languages in which they're attempting to teach students. And it's just cacophony.
So can you vote if you're on if you speak only Spanish?
Oh, yes.
You can be a citizen if you don't speak English?
Yes.
How do you take the citizenship? I mean, how do you go through the naturalization
process?
Well,
they'll just administer it to you in Spanish. Sure, really? You'll go get your driver's license in Spanish, and there you are, barreling down the highway, and the sign says, stop. And because it does not say, alto, you keep right on going.
S.I. Hayakawa, a California academic and former U.S. senator, believed that there was actually a conspiracy among non-native speakers of English to undermine the system and to, as he put it, split the U.S. into a bilingual and bicultural society. So alarmed was he that in 1983 he formed a nonpartisan lobbying group called U.S. English. Today, it has a membership of 600,000, including such luminaries as Alistair Cook, Saul Bellow, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. They believe that English should be the official language of the United States. Daphne Magnuson, director of communications for U.S. English, echoes Liddy's concerns over the extent to which the U.S. government accommodates non-English-speaking immigrants.
You can take your driver's license exam in 35 different languages in the state of California. You can take it in 18 or 19 in Connecticut, I believe. You can take it in Illinois in the same. You can take your driver's license exam in multiple languages in all but 8 different states in this country. As you can see, the tendency more and more is that government will accommodate you, that it is now the onus of the government, the burden of the government, to provide services for you in whatever language versus the onus and the burden being on the person that has come to this country and who came here to take advantage of economic opportunities or educational things, whatever it could have been. Suddenly, they seem to be eluding that burden. It seems to be that the government says, you don't have to learn English. We'll provide for you everything that you need in other languages. And it's kind of moving away from the old social contract. You know, your government provides for you, but you also provide certain things in return for living here.
Magnuson insists that U.S. English's intention is not to drive other languages underground.
We believe strongly that any language that you can speak is an asset, and you ought to learn to speak as many as possible, but if you live in the United States and you want to take advantage of living here, English should first and foremost be the language that you need.
Even if it's not your first language.
Even if it's not your first language, it's the language that 97% of the people that live here do speak, and it's the language that you need to be able to take advantage of the American dream. People come here because they want to get a new great job. They come here because they want to start a new life, or they want to do better for their family than they've ever done. And frankly, if you can't speak English, you're doomed to being a busboy or a hotel maid or a second-class citizen.
U.S. English can claim many successes. Thanks in part to its prodding, 14 states have passed laws making English the stipulated language of government, courts, state schools, and other public forums. Professor Donaldo Macedo, who heads the English as a Foreign Language program at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, is an outspoken critic of English-only legislation.
What we have today is basically symptomatic of society in crisis once more. Every time a society is in crisis, then you need to create, you know, a demon. You need to create the other so the other can be dehumanized and demonized. Now, the other is the high influx of immigrant from the third world countries, particularly from Latin America, from countries like Haiti, Cuba, and so on and so forth. So with that in mind, that is the context for the English only. You know, the movement is funded at the tune of $2 million to fight bilingual education, to fight the education of immigrants, to do away with laws that, for instance, would enable you, an immigrant, for instance, to get a driver's license in his language or her language, so he can just then be more mobile to take a job elsewhere and so on and so forth. To fight, for instance, the provision of interpreters in the court. So, for instance, if you are caught in the justice system, somebody will be able then to speak your language and represent you, with equity and so on and so forth. So it's more than just education. It has all kinds of ramifications. Orphans, like in many, many cases, you go into a hospital, you can't speak. There are no interpreters, you know. You end up dying because you cannot really communicate, you know, with the health staff. I mean, the ramification is beyond education. You know, it is the issue of the end of the century in education, multiculturalism, and the issue of language. You know, competition. What language you're going to use, and whose language? You know, and what would be the vehicle of the debate?
Whatever the legislative situation, there are those who will resist erosion of their own language. Moedke Schechter of the Yiddish League in New York.
Yes, we try to avoid assimilating. We try to strengthen whatever small positions we do have. And we are always anxious not to have even little things that weaken our position. This wouldn't be such a little thing. We don't have to force the English language down the throat of the small minority that doesn't know English. They would, even today, they feel, if they don't know English well, they feel like an oppressed minority. I know, for instance, many Russian immigrants. And the fact that they don't know English makes them suffer, even now when English isn't an official language. But it gives them a good feeling. Let's say they go in a certain institution and they see a communique, a press release, an announcement in English, Spanish, Russian, etc. It makes them feel at home, although their dream is to know English well.
Despite the worries of people like G. Gordon Liddy and the members of U.S. English, nearly all evidence shows that immigrants willingly learn the prevailing language of their adopted society. A study in California, for instance, found that English is already spoken by 95% of the children of Mexican immigrants, and that by the second generation, more than half can speak only English. If history is anything to go by, then three things about America's immigrants are as certain today as they ever were: that they will become Americans, that they will learn English, and that that English will be American English. And that is not, believe me, at all a bad thing.
Divided by a common language,
was presented by Bill Bryson, produced by Brian King, and originally broadcast on BBC Radio 4 between the 29th of July and the 2nd of September 1995.